Saturday, April 9th, Old Kent Road, London, England. Peel stood watching Bascombe Coombs, once again not having a clue what the man was doing.
Here we go. We insert the passwords. We have rascaled from the gatekeepers. Thus, and we are in.
He tapped at the keyboard, his fingers dancing like little elves over the thing. He hummed to himself and laughed softly. He turned from the computer screen, all awash with complex lines and clots of numbers and letters.
How's your desire for power, Terence?
Excuse me?
Come over here and press this key, and for a few milliseconds you'll be the most powerful man in the world. You'll have more of an effect on people's lives than anyone else on the planet.
Peel didn't move.
Ah, you hesitate. You must know the dictum, with great power comes great responsibility.
Churchill? The scientist smiled.
Spider-Man, actually. Sure you don't want to do the deed?
Peel shook his head.
Well, onward and upward, then.
He tapped the key once, smartly.
That ought to give the rabble something to think about.
Hmm? Commander Michaels? Michaels looked up from his desk. He didn't recognize the man standing there. Yes?
D.G. Hamilton wanted me to deliver this to you, sir.
He handed a silvery disc about the size of a quarter to Michaels.
If you'll thumbprint here, sir?
He held a print reader out. Michaels pressed his right thumb against a small gray panel on the device. The messenger looked at the readout and was apparently satisfied with the print match.
Thank you, sir.
Michaels ran the disc. Things were looking up on a few fronts. The airline reservation and flight control computers were, by and large, back up and running smoothly. That was the good news. The bad news was they hadn't been able to backwalk the hack that caused the problem in the first place.
Good afternoon, Alex.
He glanced up at Angela. She was in a green T-shirt, faded and kind of tight jeans, and tennis shoes. His surprise at her outfit must have showed. She smiled and said,
"Casual Saturday."
"Ah,
anything new?"
"I was just going over the disc your boss sent over. The airlines are back online." She strolled in his direction, leaned in to look over his shoulder. He felt her right breast brush against his back. Apparently Casual Saturday meant no bra, too.
Damn.
She quickly leaned back. "Well, that's good news, at least." The young man who had delivered the disc came into the room, not exactly running, but close to it. "Commander, D.G. Hamilton would like to have a word. You as well, Cooper." "Trouble?"
"I couldn't say, sir."
"Trouble." The Ewes, Sussex, England. Lord Goswell sat in his study, sipping a gin and tonic. He heard one of the maids chattering madly at somebody in the hall. He smiled as he sipped his drink.
"What is the problem, Applewhite?"
The butler came into the room, looking apologetic.
"Sorry about the disturbance, my lord. The maid and cook were distraught."
"Whatever for?"
"It seems the telly has gone down, and the telephones are also on the blink."
"Really?"
"Yes, my lord. Can't even pick up most of the radio channels on the battery unit or in the automobiles."
"Well, that would be distressing then, wouldn't it? Think it's the Russians dropping bombs?"
"I hardly think so, my lord."
"Well, I'm sure His Majesty's government will see to whatever the problem is soonest."
"Yes, my lord."
Applewhite went back to calm the maid and cook.
Goswell had to hand it to that scientist fellow.
Not only the airlines had been knocked down again, but worldwide communications had been whacked solidly, most of the satellites taken offline, and the tele and radio signals that depended on the network of satellites had been disrupted, along with telephonic operations. Quite a stroke. And, of course, operations in the UK would come back much sooner than the rest of the world, if Bascombe Coombs' calculations were correct. And, so far, they always had been. Brilliant fellow he was.
Pity he would have to die. Good help was so hard to find.
Saturday, April 9th, in the air over the Virginia coast. NetForce's military arm had cranked up one of the old overhauled and refitted 747s for the hop to England, and John Howard sat in the thing wishing it was an SST. The sooner they got to the UK, the better. He wanted to get his hands on Ruggio right now, but at least he was on the way. He'd have to work the logistics with the Brits when they got there, but they had an arrangement with His Majesty's government, and having Alex Michaels already in England wouldn't hurt. He was dressed for travel and not the field. but he had his smaller gear pack on the empty seat next to him, and now he pawed through it. He tended to recheck his gear frequently when he went on a mission. It was a nervous habit, and he'd realized a long time ago he was going to do it, so he didn't worry about it any longer. He looked around and saw that Julio was heading for an empty washroom. Good. It wouldn't do for Julio to see what he'd done to his good luck talisman. Not yet, anyway. He removed the charm from the pack and looked at it. Talisman was a funny way of thinking about a handgun, but this was an ancient Smith & Wesson 357 Model 66 stainless steel revolver. For years, he had carried the piece as it had come stock from the box. A six-shot wheel gun, plain iron sights, no bells and whistles. He was comfortable with it. It had been on his hip every time he had gone into a firefight. Not that he was a technophobe or some kind of Luddite, but Howard had always liked the simple is better philosophy when it came to hardware. The RA and Navy Spec Force elites, the Rangers, the SEALs, the Green Hats, had all kinds of new computer-augmented personal weaponry. Things like carbines with TV cams on them. You could stick around a corner and shoot without being seen. But Howard's strike teams carried plain Jane, if top of the line, 9mm subguns. They went bang when you pulled the trigger, and you could get the ammo anywhere in the world if you ran out. Sure, they had the modified Sipe suit armor, and it had plenty of tactical computer stuff built in, low-SEER comms and headset graphics and GPS and all, but if those failed, you could at least still shoot your weapon manually. So when he looked at his trusty six-gun with the Tasco Optima 2000 dot scope mounted where the notch and post sights used to be, it felt, well, a little weird. And after all the years of shaking his head and calling the polymer sidearms Tupperware guns, his new acquisition might be thought by those who knew him to have shaded right on into the hypocritical. It wasn't all that complex, the scope. What you had was a tiny, clear plastic window mounted an inch and a half or so in front of a tiny red diode that projected a red dot onto the window. Wherever you put the dot, that was where the bullet went. The unit didn't add much bulk and was a lot easier to line up than standard iron sights. When the range master showed him this little toy on one of the range pistols, he'd tried it, just for the hell of it, and it shot 15% better the first time he tried it. At first, he tried to ignore it, but on subsequent visits to the range, he'd used the thing again. The armorer told him the red dot would make the colonel a better shooter. What was the problem? Howard hadn't said, but mostly the problem would be the taste of crow. Julio would never let him live it down. Howard didn't want his sergeant to notice just yet. Maybe when he did, things would be heated up enough so it wouldn't require an explanation. He looked up and saw Julio coming back from the can. He shoved the revolver back into his bag. At the same time, one of the flight crew, the navigator, approached from the other direction. Colonel? He looked at the navigator. Yes? We have a problem, sir? Saturday, April 9th, Johannesburg, South Africa. The new light rail shuttle train carrying 674 passengers from Pretoria to Johannesburg blew through the scheduled stop at Tembisa Station at almost 140 kilometers per hour. The engineer threw the manual override, took control from the computer, applied the brakes, and the train began slowing. It would have been all right, except for the second passenger train stalled just south of Tembisa. The shuttle was doing more than 90 when it plowed into the back of the stopped train that was supposed to be 10 minutes ahead and moving at speed. Both trains buckled, and more than two-thirds of each left the tracks, accordioned like toys jammed together by a spoiled child. Half the people in the rear car of the stopped train were killed instantly. Others were thrown from the smashed car to their deaths. A few were electrocuted by downed power lines. The engineer of the moving train stayed at his post and died there. His last words, as recorded by the black box, were, "Oh, shit." Estimates of the dead were ballpark, but the number was more than 200. Nobody even worried about the third shuttle following 10 minutes later. They should have. The engineer on this train frowned as he realized that his communications gear was out and that his vehicle was going too fast as it approached the station. By the time he wrested control away from the computer, it was too late. His last words would never be known, as the impact was sufficiently violent to destroy this train's black box, leaving only a burned-out husk. Saturday, April 9th, Kona, Hawaii. The beacon switched off just as the L-1011-C3 wide-body jumbo jet from Japan came in for a landing at Kona during a tropical shower. The pilot apparently overreacted as the plane yawed, and JAL dropped hard enough to collapse the rear landing gear on the port side. The big craft slewed starboard, spun, and slid sideways across the runway, square into a Hawaiian Air MD-80 waiting to taxi for takeoff. The smaller bird spewed flaming jet fuel, ignited, and the resulting fireball set the larger craft on fire. There was a terrific explosion. Tourists waiting inside the airport were killed as shattered aluminum slid like shrapnel through the open-walled design terminal. Pieces of the jumbo jet and human body parts rained down as far as half a mile away. 480 died in the crash. 14 were killed outright in the terminal. Saturday, April 9th, Perth, Australia. Despite heroic measures, 18 polio patients breathing on respirators at the Dundee Memorial Hospital died when the backup generators failed after a power outage blacked out the city. Saturday, April 9th, MI6, London, England. Oh, Lord, Alex Michaels said. He's killing people. Yes, Cooper said. He's bollocks dozens of major systems. I don't see how it is possible. Neither did Michaels. Communications, transportation, even traffic signals were screwed up. Who was this guy? The building around them hummed with frantic energy. He looked at Tony. We need to talk to our people at home. Unless you have a fast carrier pigeon, good luck, Tony said. The landlines that work via the Atlantic cable are jammed. I can't believe it. He's managed to shut down virtually everything tied into a major computer net. The power is beyond anything we've ever seen, Cooper said. That was for damn sure. Worse, why was the hacker doing it? What did he stand to gain? Was he a terrorist? Michaels knew he needed to do something, but what? What could you do when the tools you normally used were all broken? Better come up with some new ones, Alex, or this guy is going to bring the whole planet to a screeching halt. Saturday, April 9th, London, England. Ruggiero stood in front of the post office across from Westminster Cathedral. He was aware of the frantic scurrying around him. There had been a major computer and power failure, it seemed. He had noticed that the traffic signals were out, but that did not distract him so much that he missed the man angling in toward him from the left, dodging traffic as he hurried across Victoria Street. That the man was coming toward him, for him, was certain. The man was young, fit, smiling, but that meant nothing. Ruggiero had smiled at some of the people he had deleted. It was disarming, a big smile. It allayed suspicion. How dangerous was a man grinning at you? Such a man could be deadly, Ruggiero knew. But was this one so? Though dressed like a layabout in a leather jacket and jeans, the young man moved like a soldier. Ruggiero was unarmed, save for a small pocket knife. True, he could kill with the knife at grappling range, if need be, but if he was bracketed by a collection or a deletion team, then he was already caught or dead. Ruggiero put his hand into his right trouser pocket and found the small knife. But if he was targeted, and if he took his hand out of his pocket with a weapon, he'd probably be dead before he could get the knife cleared. Were there crosshairs laid upon his brow? A jittery laser spot dancing on the back of his head? He looked around again, but he could not spot the shooter. Nor did he see any others on the street paying him undue attention. Were they there? Had he gotten so old he had lost his ability to spot death watching him? Or was the leather-jacketed man alone? The smiling man achieved the curb and stopped 3 meters away, well outside a quick lunge with a short knife range. Mr. Ruggiero, the man said. His right hand had drifted down to the hem of his jacket by his hip. There was a weapon there, a knife or a gun. Yes. No point in denying it. This man wouldn't be taken in by a protestation of mistaken identity. Hello, sir. I'm Corporal Huard. Major Terence Peel sends his regards and wonders if you might be free for dinner this evening. Peel? How did he know Ruggiero was in London? And what did he want? The young soldier offered Ruggiero a card. It had an address on it. About 7 o'clock, all right? Huard said. Ruggiero nodded. Will you be needing directions or a ride? No. Right then. See you later. Huard smiled, turned, and marched off. Ruggiero watched him until the man was out of sight. Nobody else joined him. Huard seemed to have been alone. But even so, he should have spotted him sooner. Ruggiero looked at the card. Peel. How interesting. It had been nearly 2 years since he had met the man. The major had trained one of the paramilitary units for Plekhanov. What was he doing now? And how had he known Ruggiero was here? On this corner, at this time? He must have had his men following him. Why? And why hadn't he noticed a tail sooner? He put the card into his pocket, the address already committed to memory. He would go and find out. Saturday, April 9th, somewhere in the British Raj, India. Jay wasn't alone this time. He had brought a native guide to stand watch. Well, it was actually a motion detector program, one that would squeal if anybody or anything entered his scenario uninvited and warn him in time to get his gun ready. At least, he hoped it would warn him in time. Having the program look like a turbaned native guide was as good as anything, and he had altered the scenario a little more. Now, the weapon he had on a strap digging into his shoulder and leveled ready at his hip was a shotgun. And not just an ordinary shotgun, but a South African street sweeper, a short-barreled semi-automatic. If something moved in front of him, all Jay had to do was point the gun and start pulling the trigger, and he could put up a screaming maw of deadly metal teeth that would chew up anything in their path. Nothing alive could eat that much lead and keep coming. "Keep a sharp eye out," Jay said. "Yes, Sahib." Jay bent to look at the ground using the new skills he had learned from Saji in the New Mexico desert scenario. Cutting sign and looking as much for what wasn't there as much as what was. He knew that the tiger must have gone this way because, in the perverse logic of computer VR, it couldn't have gone this way. And since he knew that, he should be able to track it. You couldn't move through this kind of brush without leaving a sign. The smelly jungle heat washed over him. He could have made a more pleasant scenario, a nice ski lodge in the Alps, a sunny ocean beach at Malibu, but this was the place where the tiger had jumped him, and this was the place he had to get back on the figurative horse. If he didn't, he knew he would always be afraid, and you couldn't web walk if you were afraid. There were too many set-piece scenarios you had to live in, too many jungles out there to avoid them all. The fear tasted like warm zinc in his mouth. Once upon a time, he had been Super Jay, but not anymore. The tiger's massive claw had wiped that invulnerability away. It had shown Jay the darkness he had known intellectually, but had not really in his heart of hearts believed. He believed it now. He hated the tiger for that, for making him afraid. His faith had been in himself, in his own abilities, and the tiger had taken that from him. Saji's talk of Buddhism had helped, and he felt drawn to that religion because it was so pragmatic and based in earthly reality. But it hadn't erased the fear. He saw a mark in the jungle floor, a slight depression on a patch of old leaves and twigs long since rotted to damp humus. He glanced up at the guide, who stood scanning the jungle, then back at the mark. It had gone this way. Which meant that Jay was going to have to go this way, too. He raised from his crouch. "Come on, Mowgli, through here."
"Yes, Sahib."
So far, the scenario was holding steady. That was something. He wondered how long he could maintain the surrounding imagery if he saw the tiger. Not very long, he figured. Jay took a deep breath, adjusted the shotgun strap, and started forward. Peel smiled at Huard. Inside his office, the former church, the younger man looked somehow out of place. Probably hadn't been in a church since he was a lad. "And your impression of the fellow?" "Well, sir, he didn't seem all that swift. I mean, he didn't see me until I stepped in front of him. I'd say he's lost most of his moves since he was with the Russians, if he ever had any moves, sir." Peel nodded. "You have the recording?"
"Right here."
Huard tendered an info ball the size of a marble. Peel slotted the info ball into the computer's reader and clicked it on. The holographic projection appeared at 1/6 scale over Peel's desk. The image of Ruggiero from the minicam in Huard's belt buckle was remarkably sharp and stable. Ruggiero stood on the street corner staring into space. Yes, well, he did look distracted. Hello? Computer, stop play. Rewind 50 frames, replay magnification times 3. Watch Huard and learn. The image blinked and began again, larger, a closer view of Ruggiero. There, just as the image waggled a little. That would be Huard stepping from the curb. Rougeau's eyes shifted. Peel grinned. That's where he spotted you, Corporal.
Sir?
He's just seen you across the street, and without moving his head too much, he's checking out his surroundings, looking for other players. Heward shook his head.
I don't see it, sir.
He's got a weapon in his pocket. If you had made any sudden moves once you got there, he would have cut your throat or put a couple of small-caliber bullets into you. Heward didn't believe him, but he said,
Well, if you say so, sir.
Peel grinned. Youth was so wasted on the young.
That's all, then. Carry on.
Sir, Heward came to attention, did an about-face, and left the building. Computer, replay sequence. The machine obeyed. Peel watched. He did enjoy watching a real professional at work. He was looking forward to seeing Rougeau again. Good men were hard to find. Sunday, April 10th, London, England. Tony didn't have any spare time, not with the crisis as dramatic as it was, but she'd realized long ago that if she didn't exercise, she wouldn't be much good in the middle of a high-stress environment. She had to have a valve to bleed off the pressure. So this morning, the workout was going to have to come off the top. Not yet 5 a.m. and she was up, washing her face, the bathroom door closed so as not to wake Alex, dressing in sweats for a trip to the hotel's gym. In truth, she was a little excited. Carl Stewart was going to meet her in the hotel's gym. When she'd gone by his school and explained to him that her job was keeping her from his class in the evenings, he'd offered to meet her for private sessions, and it turned out he was an early riser.
Well, in that case, I'd love to train with you.
There's a decent gym in your hotel, he said. Save your taxi ride to the school.
And cost you one.
Not really, I have a car. And it's not all that far from where I live. I have a flat in Knightsbridge.
Knightsbridge? That's a pretty nice area, isn't it?
We drove through there. By Hyde Park?
He looked embarrassed.
Yes, well, my parents got a bit of an inheritance from my grandfather, and they have a small family business that does all right.
As she headed for the hotel's gym, Tony grinned to herself. She checked out the real estate in the area called Knightsbridge. Flats went for the equivalent of $500,000 U.S. dollars. Apparently, the Stewart family business was doing all right indeed.
Carl was waiting in the gym.
Good morning, he said.
Morning. He was warming up and stretching, and she joined him. After 10 minutes of Juros, Carl stopped.
Want to work some combinations?
Sure. Once again, Tony thrilled at the knowledge that Carl was a superior player. None of her attacks and counterattacks got through. He blocked them effortlessly. This was great, just what she needed. He was showing her a takedown he liked. They were pressed together, her groin against his thigh, his right hand on her butt, levering for a hip sweep, when she caught a glimpse of somebody watching them from the hall. She didn't have time to look as Carl completed the throw, taking out her leg and dropping her to the carpet, following up with a kick and punch. When she got to her feet, the watcher in the hall was gone.
Again? Carl asked.
Yes, she grinned. This was really great. Alex felt a sour pain in his belly, a churning, twisted feeling. He had felt it before and knew it for what it was. Jealousy. He had watched them together in the workout room, Tony and the English Silat instructor, seen them glued together, the man's hand on her ass. Yeah, sure, it was part of the deal. He knew enough of the art to know that, but still it bothered him as he hurried down the hall toward their room. He'd gotten up and gone to watch them work out. Maybe he could learn something, he'd figured. Yeah, right. He'd learn how to feel up somebody's butt. He knew he was being unreasonable. It wasn't the man's hands on Tony that bothered him as much as how much she was obviously enjoying herself. Probably it was just the Silat.
Probably.
But what if it was more? Maybe she was interested in the big Englishman. Yeah, okay, she said she loved him, but Michael's ex-wife had said that too, and now she didn't. Maybe she even hated him after he punched out her new boyfriend. He reached his room, carded the lock, stepped inside. He didn't need this. No way, no how. Not given the other crap falling from the sky right now. Why couldn't life be simple? And why did it always have to be so damned emotional? The way he'd been raised, a man didn't walk around with his heart on his sleeve. His father had been career army, and Michaels had never once seen the old man cry. The old man hadn't had a lot of deep conversations with his son, but one of the deepest had been about what men did and did not do. You took a hit, you sucked it up, and you kept going.
You never let anybody know they'd gotten to you. If it's killing you, you smile. That keeps your enemy off balance. Michaels knew he didn't need to hold himself so tight, that it was no sin to feel things, but those old tapes from his childhood were hard to get past. It wasn't just his career that had killed his marriage. That don't show emotions lesson had been part of the problem with his ex-wife, he knew. And now, it seemed to be part of the problem with Tony. What to do about it? He shook his head. He couldn't deal with this now. He had a job, a nut with some magical computer gear killing people, bringing the world more grief. He had to deal with his problems the way the samurai warrior Musashi had spoken of it. When faced with 10,000, you fight them one at a time, the most dangerous ones first. His emotional life would just have to wait. He left a note for Tony, then called for a cab to take him to MI6. Sunday, April 10th, Washington, D.C. It was a beautiful sunny morning, no wind, a perfect day to throw. Tyrone glanced at his watch, 10 a.m. Where was Nadine? She was supposed to meet him at the soccer field at... Wait, there she was, coming around the gym, a backpack slung over one shoulder. She saw him, grinned, and waved. Hey, Tyrone! He waved back. Tyrone had brought four of his favorite rings, along with pixie dust and his timer. Nadine had three rings, some fingertip wind check, and a stopwatch. They warmed up, rolled their shoulders and waved their arms back and forth, shook out their hands, something Tyrone had learned from watching the older throwers. Nadine went to take a few practice throws, and he watched her carefully. She was in good shape, and she had excellent form when she threw. She used her whole body and not just her arm, what you were supposed to do. You could learn a lot watching somebody good work. They'd been throwing for about half an hour when Tyrone saw three or four people watching them from across the field. It took only one quick look to see that one of the watchers was Belladonna Wright. Though he was trying hard not to look at Bella, Nadine picked up on it.
Well, well, looks like that old fire might not be out after all, hey, Ty?
What?
You and Sweetie Pie over there under the tree. You kind of acted like you didn't know her real well, but from what I hear, you and she spent some quality time together.
So what if we did?
Nothing, not my business. I just hate to see you get cooked, is all.
What do you mean?
Come on, Tyrone. Give me a bye here. Pretties like that go through guys like toilet paper. Use them, flush them. There's plenty more where the last one came from. She's got a string of guys waiting to run around behind her and kiss the ground she walks on.
Oh, yeah? How would you know that?
Nadine stared at the ground.
You hear stuff?
Anything else you hear?
I'm not trying to start a fight.
Could have fooled me.
She looked up, hefted her MTA.
I came to practice. You interested in that? Or you want to wait for Miss America to crook her finger so you can go running?
I don't go running. For your information, it was my idea to break up with Bella.
Well, that wasn't strictly true, but he had opened the conversation that led to it. And when given the choice of being one of her string, he had told her he wasn't interested.
Sort of.
Well, good for you. You gonna throw?
Tyrone glanced at Bella, then back at Nadine.
Yeah, I'm gonna throw. Get ready to start your watch. I'm gonna hang you out to dry.
In your dreams. She flashed him a small grin, and he returned it. But even as he did, he wondered about what she had said. What if Bella crooked her finger? Would he go running?
No way. No fucking way.
He gathered himself for the throw. Three steps. One, two, three. The boomerang soared high into the air, climbing for the sun. And it was going to be a long hang time, too, he could tell. That ought to shut Nadine up about whether he'd come to throw.
Sunday, April 10th, somewhere over the Atlantic Ocean. Flying the big jet wasn't a problem for the Net Force pilot, and landing it manually wasn't either. But trying to land in heavy traffic at Heathrow or Gatwick without some help from the ATCs on the ground was not at the top of any pilot's list.
No way in hell, sir, the pilot had put it to Howard.
Fortunately, there were military bases that were self-contained in the UK, and they could put the big bird down at one of these, even though the wait would be fairly long. They might be stacked up a while waiting to land. Fine, he'd been stacked up before. They could have turned the 747 back and landed in the States, but Howard wasn't interested in letting his quarry get away again, not if they could help it. The good thing was, if they were having problems traveling, so would Rougeau. Julio drifted down the aisle and stopped next to his seat.
Colonel?
Sergeant?
You still think we can collect this boy?
Oh, we'll get him. Howard mentioned his reasoning. Fernandez laughed. Begging the colonel's pardon, but bullshit. He waves a handful of that funny euro money at some college kid or poor fisherman or broke pilot with an ultralight, and he's got wheels or floats or wings. His chances of getting nailed in all the hubbub are probably so close to zero as to practically be zero. You're assuming he wants to leave England that bad. Why should he? He doesn't know we're on his tail. He probably thinks he's gotten clean away. Would you assume that? Were you in his shoes? Howard grinned. Hell no. Me neither. But shoot, we could get lucky. He might step off a curb and get hit by a double-decker bus or something. Be waiting for us in a hospital somewhere, nothing but a tongue depressor to fight us with when we show up. Of course, with our luck so far, he'd kill a couple of us with it. And wouldn't that look good on the obituary page? Assassin kills Net Force personnel. It was depressing, Sergeant Julio Fernandez said. I can always count on you to cheer me up, Sergeant.
I do what I can, sir.
Sunday, April 10th, MI6, London, England. Michael sat hunched over a stack of hard copy, reading that instead of using the computer. It was slow going. Tony had arrived, but left again to collect some material from a satellite recon site that still had a viable uplink. They didn't want to risk sending the stuff from there to here, even with protected landlines. His neck and upper back were stiff and sore. Part of that was probably from being stuck in a chair reading for hours. Part of it was tension from all the other crap going on in his head. Megan and the private eye, Tony, the whole ugly situation with this madman screwing with the world.
Knock, knock.
Angela Cooper came in.
How goes the war, Alex?
Our side is still losing. We've gotten a bunch of systems back online. Well, that's something. She moved in behind him and looked over his shoulder.
Statistical analysis of transcontinental telephonic transmissions. My, this must be fascinating reading.
She laid a hand on his shoulder.
Oh, dear. You're like a rock.
I've been more relaxed.
You should let me work on you.
She put her other hand on his other shoulder and started to knead the muscles. He had a moment of alarm. He should not allow this, but... it felt good. Her hands were much stronger than he would have thought.
You don't have to do that.
Weak. Not the same as telling her to quit.
Well, I don't mind. It's one of my few talents. My mother was a therapist for a time. She knew some of the movements of massage. Reiki, Shiatsu, Aston patterning. I picked up some of it along the way.
God, but that felt good.
You really ought to lie down to get the full benefit. Lie on the floor on your stomach next to the desk there.
Like a man in a trance, Michaels obeyed. He hadn't realized just how tight he was. Face down, he felt her straddle him. Her butt was lightly touching his.
Oh, yes. It would be better with your shirt off, but perhaps we ought to wait on a more private setting for that. Wouldn't want tongues to wag.
The way Michaels felt with her working on his back, he didn't care if all the tongues in MI6 wagged like a pack of starving dogs being offered liver treats. He could feel himself loosening under the hard pressure. She slid backward, hovered over his hamstrings, and leaned onto her hands against the small of his back.
Oh, man, he could get used to this.
It occurred to him after 10 minutes or so that this would be the worst time in the world for Tony to come back. He should make her stop. Now. But he didn't. And Tony didn't come back. And after 20 minutes, Angela climbed off him and stood. He could barely move. He somehow managed to get to his feet.
Thank you. You just saved my life.
It wasn't much, really. To do it right takes an hour, and you have to work both sides, back and front. I have a massage table at home. Maybe you can drop by and let me give you the full treatment sometime.
A warning flash strobed his brain. Danger, bad idea. Then he thought about Tony and her sealot workout. Stewart had put his hands all over Tony. It wasn't sex. It was harmless. It was therapeutic.
Yeah, maybe we could do that, he heard himself say.
She smiled at him, and he smiled back. After she had gone, he found that a small bit of tension quickly returned. It had nothing to do with work. What, he wondered, are you getting yourself into here, Alex?
Sunday, April 10th, The Ewes, Sussex, England. Goswell sat in his study, in the good leather chair, and sipped at his iced gin. He sighed and looked at the photographs for perhaps the 10th time.
In this age of computer miracles, it was certainly possible to fake such things, he knew. He shuffled the pictures. Yes, certainly it could be done, but in this case he was just as certain that it had not been done. These were genuine enough, for the man who had taken them had not had a reason to fake them. There sat Peel, talking to Bascombe Coombs, right there in a public eatery. Of course, Goswell thought, Peel was his security chief, and Bascombe Coombs one of his employees, and a valuable one as well, so one could easily argue that such a meeting was well within the normal scope of Peel's duties. Peel could certainly justify speaking with Bascombe Coombs easily enough. The damning thing was, he had not done so. Nowhere in his reports was there any mention of such a meeting, nor of the subsequent meetings. There were other photographs. Goswell shook his head. Damned bad show, this. Question was, what were these two about? That they were in league together certainly meant something. Well, he had not gotten to be a general of industry without learning how to figure such things out. He rattled the cubes in his nearly empty glass rather loudly.
Milord, another drink?
Yes, please. Oh, and Applewhite, see if you can find Major Peel, would you, and have him drop round after dinner?
Certainly, milord.
Goswell would take the Quisling Peel's measure one way or another. A damned shame, really. Good thing the boy's father was gone. It would break his heart to know his son had betrayed a trust. Sunday, April 10th, London, England. A light rain had begun falling, and Ruggiero figured this would be a perfect excuse. He caught a cab near the British Museum and gave the driver the address he wanted. It was not far from a shop on a side street, not far from Regent's Park, a tiny slot of a storefront, long and narrow, that specialized in handcrafted umbrellas and canes. You could easily drop a couple of hundred in such a place on a handmade walking stick or bumper chute, considerably more if you so wished. They were big on such things here, the accoutrements of a gentleman, and likely the shop could make ends meet just with such sales alone. However, there were other items to be had by a knowledgeable buyer. The cab arrived a block from the destination. Ruggiero paid the fare. The rain was coming down a little harder, and Ruggiero made certain he didn't appear to notice the man following him as he walked. When he arrived at the shop he wanted, he made a show of looking irritated at the weather and offered what he hoped would seem a spur-of-the-moment decision to duck into the place. It would all be for nothing if Peel knew what the shop's merchandise included, but unless things had changed recently, the Brits did not clue on the umbrella store. The meeting with Peel had been interesting. His claim that he had spotted Ruggiero by having every passport picture of every foreigner entering the country compared to a list of known agents seemed far-fetched, but Peel had managed to spot him somehow. The assignment, to stand for a possible elimination of an English lord who just happened to be Peel's employer, was intriguing, although Ruggiero doubted he would actually attempt the deletion. Peel's flimsy explanation as to why he couldn't do the job himself, or to have one of his men do it, wasn't fooling anybody. It was obvious that he needed a scapegoat, a foreign agent who could be blamed for the assassination. Ruggiero allowed himself a small smile as the umbrella shop clerk took notice of him and nodded. May I help you, sir?
I need a special umbrella, one with more heft than the ordinary.
The clerk's smile never wavered.
Ah, yes. I'll have the manager, Mr. O'Donnell, write out.
The clerk disappeared into a door behind the counter.
Good afternoon, sir. I'm Mr. O'Donnell. I understand you need a special umbrella.
Ruggiero nodded at the tall, sandy-haired man in the dark suit.
Yes. And might I ask who recommended our shop to you?
That would be Colonel Webley Scott.
Ah, I see. And how is the Colonel these days?
The identity code was the same. Ruggiero said,
Still dead, last I heard.
The manager smiled and nodded.
If you will step this way, sir.
Ruggiero followed O'Donnell to a small private room. There was a tall, green, antique safe on claw feet in one corner. As the manager opened the safe, he said,
Would you be wanting something edged or projectile, sir?
Do you have a multiple projectile model?
We have. A five-shooter. Small caliber, I'm afraid, only 22.
That will do.
Here we are, then.
He offered what appeared to be a standard umbrella to Ruggiero, with the J-shaped wooden handle perhaps a hair thicker and heavier than normal.
Handle unscrews here. Inside you'll notice the back of the cylinder. It's a revolver, you see.
Ruggiero looked at the five small holes in the tiny cylinder inside the umbrella shaft. The firing pin and rest of the action was in the removed J-section.
Ingenious.
One puts the shells in like so, threads the handle back on until it locks, thus. Trigger unfolds from the handle, thus. Use this little notch, much like a penknife blade. It is double action only, of course, and there aren't any sights, but a man proficient with firearms can point shoot it rather well.
Rougeau took the disguised carbine, hefted it.
And is there a place where I can test it?
O'Donnell nodded, approving.
That box over there. It's full of baffles and has a steel backstop.
He wasn't offended. Only a fool would trust his life to a weapon he had not personally tested to see if it would work.
Ammunition?
I have some stingers, solids and hollow points.
Excellent.
How much?
2,000.
Done.
Tail was across the street in a sandwich shop, a young man, hair cut short, who could have been Huard's brother from his general look. The rain was still coming down, so Rougeau held his newly acquired and fully loaded short carbine up and utilized the secondary function. The black silk canopy expanded crisply on its titanium struts and locked into place. Rougeau smiled to himself as he walked away from the shop. Peel would get him weapons, of course, but it was much better to have a hidden trump, just in case.
Sunday, April 10th, somewhere in the British Raj, India. The heat and dampness were oppressive, and the sour odor of the tiger spoor permeated the leaden air. He was close, the tiger, and the scent of his scat was mixed in with the stink of Jay's own fear. Jay and his native guide followed the footprints across an open stretch of ground. No doubt of it, no way to mistake the trail. It led across the open stretch into a dense patch of bush. Jay shifted his sweaty grip on the street sweeper. The tiger had gone into that thicket, and if Jay wanted it, he was going to have to go in after it. The prospect filled him with a fright bordering on the edge of stark, gibbering terror. Jay stopped walking. What he wanted to do was bail from this scenario. He wanted to find a South Sea island somewhere in real time. The last thing on earth he wanted to do was traipse into that fecund wall of jungle, and if he did it, it might well be the last thing he ever did. But he had to go. If he didn't, he might as well hang it up as a player. If he didn't find and destroy this beast, he was as good as brain dead. They were almost to the wood when his native guide said, "Sahib, behind us!" Jay spun and saw the tiger charging them, impossibly fast. He had maybe half a second and he knew it wouldn't be enough. "Bail!" he screamed. Washington, D.C. Jay fell out of VR in his apartment, heart pounding, the panic filling him. The tiger! The tiger! He couldn't even breathe. At his core, he knew he had to go back. Before it got away, he had to go back. He wanted to scream, to cry, to run, anything but what he had to do. Instead, he said, "Resume." Somewhere in the British Raj, India. Jay arrived in time to see the huge tiger sinking its terrible fangs into his detection program, the native guide, mangling it into a bloody ruin. Poor Mowgli. Jay snapped the shotgun up as the tiger realized he had returned. The great beast coughed, roared, and spun to face him. No hesitation, it charged. Jay stood his ground, aimed. 50 feet away, 40 feet, 30. He squeezed the trigger. The shotgun bucked against his shoulder, lifted from the recoil. He fired again, too fast, too high. But the first blast hit the charging monster. It screamed in surprise and pain, sheered off and ran for the forest. Jay saw blood on one of the tiger's shoulders as it wheeled around and ran. He had hit it. It was fleeing. It wasn't invincible. A surge of triumph washed his fear away. Jay had faced it down, shot it, driven it off. The victory was short-lived, though. Now what he had was a wounded man-eater hiding in the bush. That wasn't going to make things any easier. That didn't matter. He had to go after it, and he didn't have time to call up another warning program. He had to go now. Jay ran for the jungle. The Ewes, Sussex, England. Peel stood by the greenhouse, wishing he had a cigarette. He had quit smoking years ago, a matter of discipline more than anything, a test of his will. Everybody knew it was bad for you, but as a soldier, he had always expected he would die in the field somewhere. It was quiet, calm,
with no signs of any problems from his troops around the estate. Goswell had called him in for a visit. They'd had a pleasant drink. There was all that money sitting in the bank. Peel would be rich and powerful beyond belief in the not-too-distant future. Especially since, once the scientist's plans came to fruition, Peel planned to take him out and take over himself. On the face of it, Peel didn't see how things could be much better. However, something was wrong. There was nothing to point a finger at, no focus for his unease, but on some instinctual level, he felt it. There was a danger lurking here somewhere. Perhaps a cigarette wouldn't help him figure out what it was, but smoking had always settled his thoughts, had given him time to ponder problems. Like Sherlock Holmes with his pipe, perhaps. Well, he wasn't about to fire up again because of some vague disquiet. A walk around the grounds might serve as well. Monday, April 11th, Washington, D.C. Tyrone walked down the hall toward his first class.
Hey, Ty.
He stopped and turned, recognizing the voice from those two words. Bella Donna Wright. Hey, Bella. She wore a tight, wrap blue dress that fit like spray paint, and she had her long hair up in some kind of curly do that made her look taller.
How you doing?
He shrugged. Okay. How about you?
Okay.
I saw you out with your boomerang the other day.
Yeah.
Why was she talking to him? After he had seen her kissing that slack brain at the mall and called her on it, she had dumped him flatter than 2D. They hadn't spoken since. And here she was, passing the time of day like nothing had happened.
Haven't seen you at the mall lately, she smiled.
Haven't been there much.
You should check out the new food court.
Yeah, maybe I will. She flashed another of her perfect smiles at him.
Well, see you around.
Yeah, was all he could manage. She walked off, queen of all she passed. From the back, she was just as gorgeous. Tyrone's brain hurt. What was all that about? She smiled at him, practically invited him to the mall, acted like she was glad to see him. Last time they talked, months ago, she had verbally kicked him in the nuts when he'd called her on having other boyfriends. What the hell was going on? The bell went off and Tyrone jerked himself out of his trance and hustled his butt to his class. He wished his dad was in town. Maybe he would know what this meant. Monday, April 11th, MI6, London, England. Michael suddenly realized how quiet things had gotten at the office, and he looked at the computer's clock. Lord, it was past midnight. He was bushed. Sitting hunched over the computer all day had knotted him up again. Tony had taken the Channel train to Paris to coordinate info flow with the French authorities. She wouldn't be back until Tuesday evening. He slipped his windbreaker on and left the office.
You work late hours, Angela said from behind him.
Michael's turn. Yeah, well, you're still here, aren't you?
Just leaving. You need a ride?
I was just calling a cab, he waved to Virgil. I wouldn't want to put you out.
No trouble, really. It's practically on the way to my flat.
In that case, okay, sure.
Making much progress?
She asked as they wound their way past a pub that spilled laughing patrons onto the sidewalk.
Not much.
Us either. She waved at the happy-looking people coming out of the pub.
Fancy a pint and some late supper?
As she asked, Michaels realized that he was hungry. He'd had a sandwich at his desk at noon, nothing since.
I could eat. There's a nice quiet place not far from my flat. They serve decent fish and chips.
Again, the little danger signal cheeped in his mind, but he didn't feel like bothering with it. What harm could there be in a beer and a little fried food?
Sure, why not?
The pub was moderately full, but as she'd said, fairly quiet. They ordered fish and French fries, chips, and took pint glasses of beer to their table to wait for the food. The food arrived, and the smell of the batter-fried halibut and potatoes enveloped them in a wonderful aroma. He wasn't just hungry, he was starving. After 10 minutes of chowing down and a second round of beers, Michaels felt much better. This was nice, having a late dinner and enjoying a conversation not connected to work. Next thing he knew, it was 2 a.m. We probably should get going, he said. Work and all.
How is the muscle tension? She asked.
Not as bad as it was. She put her hand on his neck, slid it lightly down to his shoulder.
You're still tight as a violin string.
My flat is just up the road and around the corner. Would you like me to give you a massage? Maybe it was because he was so tired, Maybe it was the 2 pints of beer and the good food. Or maybe it was because she was really a handsome and intelligent woman who obviously enjoyed his company. Whatever the reason, Michaels nodded at her. Yes, I'd like that. Tuesday, April 12th, somewhere in the British Raj, India. Jay moved with all the stealth he could manage, which wasn't very much. The tiger ran straight away, making no attempt at stealth. Or so it seemed. It had sneaked up behind him once before, and Jay wasn't going to get caught unaware again. At the base of what looked to be a huge boab-like tree, the blood trail disappeared. Jay looked up. 30 feet above the ground, the tiger coughed and charged down the tree trunk, ran against gravity as if he was on level terrain. Jay didn't think. He whipped the shotgun up, spot welded his cheek to the weapon and fired. He recovered from the recoil using his whole body and fired again. The tiger fell off the tree. Jay dodged to his right, swung the gun around at waist level and pulled the trigger as the thing hit the ground hard, 5 feet away. He lost count how many times he shot. Now the tiger wasn't even twitching. Jay drew a shuddery, deep breath, his first in a while. The animal that had clawed his brain apart was dead. Even as he bent to examine it, though, he knew it wasn't the thing he sought. Oh yeah, it had attacked and damaged him, but now that he had killed it, he knew this was but a security program, not the creature that had ripped open the unbreakable cages of the world's most advanced computer systems with impossible strength. The real monster was still out there, and Jay knew this shotgun wouldn't slow it down if it spotted him. Jesus. Tuesday, April 12th, Paris, France. It was 3 a.m. and Tony couldn't sleep. The big bed in the French hotel was comfortable enough. She'd even gotten a workout in the hotel's gym and spent half an hour in the spa, letting the roiling hot water bubble and relax her. She should be conked out like a baby. Her mind was buzzing. Alex was upset with her. She could feel it, even though he denied it. And she didn't know what to do about it. Oh, she had tried to find out. Alex, is everything okay? Yep, everything is fine. You sure? Have I said or done anything to upset you? No, Tony, everything is okay. I'm just tired is all. Then he'd flashed her a tight smile that looked sincere but was hollow. How could you get past that? How many times could you ask without being a nag? If he said everything was all right, didn't she have to accept that? Well, with men, no. Not in her experience. They weren't wired the same way as women. They'd say one thing and mean something else entirely. When she got back to London, she'd find some time, would make some time, sit down with Alex, and get him to open up. They'd get it worked out. She loved him. He loved her. How hard could it be as long as they had that? Tuesday, April 12th, London, England. Angela's flat was one of a row front on Denby Street, and she did have a massage table set up in the small sitting room. Michaels remarked on that. Did she do so much massage that she left the table out all the time? No, she'd said. She'd gotten it out and put it up just today. A small alarm went off in his head. Uh-oh. She handed him a bedsheet. Take off your clothes and lie face down. Cover up with this. I'll get out of my work clothes and put on something less constricting. She moved off into the bedroom, and Michaels found himself standing in the apartment of an attractive woman he barely knew, holding a folded sheet, contemplating the removal of his clothes. This was a bad idea. Then again, she did have a real massage table. What the hell? He stripped to his underwear, a pair of black silk bikini briefs Tony had bought for him, stretched out on the table face down and pulled the sheet over himself. When Angela came back into the room, she wore a pair of gray sweatpants and a tank top. Sweatpants. Sweatpants were good. Ready? Sure. She spent about 30 minutes working on his back. She moved to his legs, and he felt himself tense a little, but Angela was matter-of-fact about it, pummeling his hamstrings. She worked on his feet and calves, then moved to his butt, hands under the sheet. Oh, this won't do, she said, and she peeled his briefs off, slid them quickly over his legs and his feet. Angela? Relax, Alex. I can't work the muscle properly if it's covered up. He tried to relax, but with her fingers stroking his ass, that was hard. And unfortunately, that soon wasn't the only thing hard about him. But at least he was face down, so that wasn't embarrassing, just a little uncomfortable. After 5 minutes of kneading his buttocks, he was beginning to relax again when she said, Okay, turn over. Excuse me?
The back is only half of you. I need to work the front.
Turning over might be kind of... That is... Got a bit excited? Don't worry about that, Alex. I've done this before. It happens all the time. She lifted up the sheet. Turn. I'll hold this.
He wasn't thrilled with the idea of rolling onto his back and showing her where his mind had gone, but... All right, fine. He kept his eyes closed and rolled over.
My, how lovely.
He opened his eyes as Angela dropped the sheet to the floor and climbed on the table to straddle him. Her sweatpants were gone, and she wasn't wearing anything under them. In another second later, he was going to be wearing her, and he knew if that happened, his mind would shut down completely. He would be lost. Hey, Angela. Look, I really can't do this.
You obviously can, and certainly you want to. I can tell.
She pointed at him.
Yes, but the thing is, I can't. I'm involved.
She'll never find out from me. Nobody will ever know. He shook his head. I'll know. She leaned back, looked down at him.
You sure about this?
He sighed.
Yeah.
Michaels came out of a troubled doze back in his room with the sound of his Virgil.
Tony. Oh, man.
He was in deep shit now.
Yeah, okay, he hadn't actually done anything, but he should never have gone to Angela's flat. The last thing he wanted to do now was talk to anybody, and especially he did not want to talk to Tony.
He left the visual off.
Hello?
Hey, boss?
Jay Gridley. Thank God.
Jay, how are you? Doing a lot better. I tracked down the security program that thumped my head and wrecked it.
Congratulations.
This is the easy part, boss. I still have to find the guy who created it, but it ought to be easier with this out of the way.
Good.
Is Tony around? Michaels felt a cold hand squeeze his guts.
No, she's in Paris. Be back this afternoon.
I'll give her a call. There's some stuff in her files here I need to access.
Fine.
How's London? You having a good time?
Was he having a good time? Well, no, not exactly. He was busy becoming the biggest, unfaithful, lying turd in all the world. All right, technically he wasn't unfaithful, but it sure felt as if he had been. He'd been inches away from it.
Yeah, I'm having a great time. Talk to you later, Jay. Keep me advised.
He shut off his Virgil. Jesus Christ. How could he have been so fucking stupid?
He was going to have to tell Tony about it, of course. The question was, how was he going to tell Tony? Oh, by the way, while you were in Paris, I dropped around Angela's place, took off my clothes, and let her rub my back, and almost let her rub my front.
When was that going to come up in conversation?
Man. Tuesday, April 12th, London, England. Goswell glanced over the top of his Times at Sir Harold Belworth, who sat brooding at his cigar, which had gone out from lack of attention. Goswell figured that this was a good time to broach the subject he had in mind.
I say, Harry, you recall that business you had with that Armenian fellow a few months ago?
Belworth snorted.
Oh, I could hardly forget that. Blasted damned rogue the man was, mucking about in my business.
I heard he met with an unfortunate accident, the Armenian.
I should say he did. Fell off of a platform in the tube station and was squashed by a train. Served him right. No loss of the world at all, but damn foreigner. Why on earth are you bringing up such a distasteful subject, Gossie?
Well, I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I have a somewhat similar problem myself. I do believe I need someone discreet to handle it for me.
You have your own people to attend to such things, surely?
I'm afraid one of my own people is the problem. Having one of his underlings take care of him wouldn't do at all, would it?
Heavens no. Bad for morale and all that. I understand completely. Well then... Shall I put in a call to my fellow? Have him ring you up?
If it wouldn't be too much trouble, Harry?
Not at all, not at all. Consider it done.
Goswell smiled. It would seem he was going to have to take direct control of his own personal war on the world's foolishness, given as how his primary tools had somehow gotten bent. He sighed. You simply could not get dependable help these days, not of the caliber that once was.
Such a pity.
London, England. Tony didn't expect to see Alex waiting for her when she got through the throng at the Channel train station, but there he was. Alex, what are you doing here? They hugged. He took her bag and said, I missed you. Welcome back, sweetie. How'd it go? Okay. They really are well-mannered, most of the French. It's only the few who give them such a bad reputation. Well, okay, more than a few, but it wasn't so bad. Anything happening here? No, not really. Well, except that I got a call from John Howard. He's landed at an Air Force base north of here.
The Colonel? Why?
Plekhanov's hired gun Ruggio. They traced him to England. Great. One more brick on the load. He didn't say anything to that. You look tired. I didn't sleep well. I bet I can help you fall asleep tonight. I bet so. She squeezed his arm. You talked to Jay? He called me. He's doing better. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. And he says he's making progress toward finding our hacker. About time we had some good news on that front. He seemed a little bit stiff, but just to look at him, he was obviously tired. A nice hot shower and crawling under the cover together would do wonders for both of them. She had missed lovemaking with him. And, truth be known, she was getting horny from all the working out with Carl. Best drain that tension and be done with it. London, England. Ruggio met Peel at a corner in front of a giant Coke sign that flashed thousands of lights overhead. They were to discuss his assignment, but when he asked about it, Peel shook his head. Let's leave off on that for a moment. I've got something else I need you to do. Ruggio raised one eyebrow. Yes? Tourists bustled along the sidewalks. A group of schoolchildren in uniforms, holding hands in pairs, snaked past like a blue and white caterpillar. Peel looked nervous. I need somebody to cover my back. I think maybe I stepped on somebody's toes. Ruggio nodded. All right. Do we know whose? Not for certain. I have an idea, but I'd like to check further. Why me? Because you don't have any reason to want me dead. Ruggio kept his face deadpan. Not that you know of. Peel smiled short and tight. Have you gotten a gun? Not yet, Ruggio lied. Peel produced a small, zippered, dark blue nylon pouch from his jacket pocket and handed it over. Beretta, model 21A, 22 caliber. There are two extra magazines already loaded. It will do. And it shoots how? Dead on at 7 yards, 2 inches high and slightly right at 25 yards. The Russian faded into the background, just another foreign tourist with an umbrella, to keep potential trouble off Peel's ass. Peel felt a little better, a little safer. Maybe it was all in his mind, but he hadn't kept his body and soul together by ignoring his inner alarms. Now and again he was wrong, and nothing amiss ever turned up. But why take the chance? There was no enemy in sight here, but he felt the fear. The only cause, he could figure, was the scientist. Nobody else knew what he was doing, and the man certainly had something to hide. It didn't make sense, not with Bascom Coombs giving him a bloody million and making him a kind of partner in the scheme, but who else could it be? And in truth, he hadn't seen the money stacked up neatly on a table somewhere, had he? It was all electronically vouched for by the Indonesian bank, and normally that would have been enough, but Bascom Coombs was owner and operator of the world's nastiest computer, wasn't he? Surely he could fool somebody not computer savvy enough to know the difference, if that was his wish. Why would he wish to do that? Peel did not have a clue, but something was lurking out there, and he did not wish to become its victim. Tuesday, April 12th, Washington, D.C. Sojan Rinpoche, the guru, was coming to see Jay. Saji was coming here to his apartment in the flesh, and Jay was more than a little nervous. The advantage of VR was that you could craft your image into anything you wanted. True, Jay tended to look like himself in a lot of scenarios because it was more trouble than it was worth to create a persona to impress somebody. Well, okay, so he touched himself up at the edges, maybe. He looked a little taller, more muscular, but not so much you couldn't recognize him in RW if he met him. Truth was a very subjective thing in virtual reality. Saji had told Jay on the net that he was going to be in D.C. for a couple of weeks and asked Jay if he wanted to meet in real time. Jay had agreed, though he had a few reservations. Sometimes you hated to meet somebody for whom you had great respect, for fear the reality wouldn't live up to your imagination. Jay had killed the tiger, but compared to what he had left to do, that was the easy part. Now he was hunting a tyrannosaur, and he was going to need a bigger gun and more nerve. Saji was going to make him spill his guts about it, about how he felt, and that wasn't going to be fun either.
The house computer said, Jay, you have a visitor. Saji was here. Jay was ready for anything. He took a deep breath and went to the door, opened it. A petite, short-haired brunette woman in blue jeans, a black t-shirt, and cowboy boots stood there. She looked to be about 25, maybe 5 feet tall, and had big dimples around a beautiful smile. There didn't seem to be any oriental cast to her features. Hello, Jay. Well, shit. He realized he wasn't ready for anything after all. Saji? He said. Son of a bitch. Not only was Saji a woman, she was young and beautiful. Now, this was not fair. Son of a bitch. Tuesday, April 12th, The Ewes, Sussex, England.
Telephone for you, sir,
Applewhite said. He came into the room carrying the instrument.
A gentleman by the name of Pound Sand, my lord. He says you were expecting his call.
Goswell paused and looked through the tubes of the shotgun he had been cleaning. Pound Sand? He didn't know anybody named that, did he? Did anyone? Someone was pulling Applewhite's leg, surely.
He says he was told to call by an old gentleman fond of Cuban cigars.
Ah, that's who it was. He reached for the phone and waved Applewhite out.
Hello?
Lord Goswell.
Yes, it is I.
A moment, please, sir. The voice seemed cultured. There came an electronic tone from the other end of the connection. Excuse the delay. One cannot be too careful, can one?
You just did a voice analysis?
Yes, my lord. And the line is secure. Our conversation is quite scrambled. I trust no one is listening in on an extension on your end. Goswell nodded to himself. Good show.
No, we're alone, Mr. Pound Sand.
The man chuckled. I hope you'll forgive me the little joke, my lord. Sir Harold has indicated that you have something of a delicate problem.
I'm afraid so, yes.
Would you like this problem resolved temporarily or permanently?
Permanently, I'm unhappy to say.
I shall attend to it immediately.
You'll need particulars.
Just the name will be sufficient, my lord. I can determine the rest.
Goswell gave the killer Peel's name.
Thank you, my lord. I'll take care of it. Goodbye, then.
Goswell hung up the phone. No discussion of money or tawdry details. How wonderful. He felt better. At least there were still a few good men out there.
London, England. Alex Michaels walked along the bank of the Thames near the Jubilee Gardens, wishing he could turn back time. His life had become a fucking soap opera. His investigation was stalled. His ex-wife wanted sole custody of their daughter. He was having a relationship with his second-in-command. Worst, he had damn near slept with someone else. He had never felt so guilty in his life. He'd never done anything like this, ever. How the hell was he going to make this right? Was it even possible to make it right? He couldn't stand the idea that he might lose Tony.
What the hell had he been thinking about? How could men do such things, cheat on their wives or significant others as he had done, almost done?
His experience was small, but he believed that women could tell these things somehow. A wrong look or word from Angela and Tony would know. That was the last thing he wanted to happen, that she find out from somebody other than him. The second to last thing he wanted to happen was that she find out from him. Oh, man. What was he going to do now? Should have thought about that when you shucked your clothes and rolled over on that massage table, pal. Should have put your brain in gear before you put your hydraulics in motion.
Ruggiero followed Peel, keeping his rented car one or two vehicles back in traffic. Ruggiero glanced at a street sign as they drove past Old Kent Road, and there off to one side was something called the Southeast Gas Works. He made a mental note of these. Peel turned into a parking lot in front of a small gray two-story building. Ruggiero drove past the lot and spotted a parking place on the street only a few meters ahead and under the overhang of a smallish live oak tree. He grinned. The first rule of automobile surveillance, as taught to him by Sergei, the old Russian Spetsnaz operative who had trained him in the basics, was always park in the shade. The warmer the day, the more important this becomes. Ruggiero pulled the car into the slot, killed the engine, and looked to make certain nobody followed Peel into the parking lot. Nobody did. Seated in the car with nothing to do but watch, Ruggiero thought again about going home. He owed no allegiance to Peel, and the money he was being paid meant nothing. He had plenty of money. But he would give this a few more days,
It was mildly interesting, and Peel had managed to spot and surprise him. That meant something in his business. A few more days wouldn't hurt. Tuesday, April 12th, Washington, D.C. Tyrone stood more or less hidden inside the sporting goods store, looking out at the food court. He'd cut classes to come to the mall. Bella was there, seated at a table in front of the Tortilla Maria, surrounded by a half a dozen girlfriends and a couple of boys. Bella laughed, and they all laughed. When she talked, they listened. She was something. He had mixed feelings about her. On the one hand, he hated her guts for how she had dropped him. She wasn't used to having guys tell her they didn't like how she was behaving, and he had sure done that. On the other hand, just look at her. She was so beautiful. She practically invited him to the mall. He could walk out of this store, kind of amble over to where she sat and see what was what. Would she smile and welcome him into the fold, or dry ice him in front of her friends, make him look like a total fool? Once upon a time, not too long ago, he'd have run as fast as he could move and never worried about it for a nanosec. He had loved her. He thought she loved him too, but that was then. Life changes a lot in a few months. No feek. This could be the time to find out where he stood, to know for sure. Thing was, did he really want to know? Being dumped once was awful. Being humiliated in public on top of that would be zero cubed. Tyrone shook his head. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Worst case scenario, he'd look like a big fool. Best case? He had an imaginary flash of Bella, naked, hair spread out on a pillow. It was vivid enough that he forgot to breathe. He was 14, and that was an image to die for. Bella, naked. Jesus Christ. When he remembered how to breathe again, Tyrone headed for the door. Do or die, Slip. Do or die. Tuesday, April 12th, London, England. John Howard stood outside the MI6 building, watching his boss walk across the street and head toward him. He waved and saw Michaels see him and wave back. Colonel, how are you?
Pretty good, sir, all things considered.
Anything new on the search for the assassin?
Yes and no. We know he came here. We have confirmation via a scan of passengers going through customs.
He tendered a hard copy color print of a man strolling through the airport.
You sure this is him?
It's him, all right. Michaels nodded at the building. Shall we go inside? As they headed along the hallway, Michaels said, It's been almost a week. He could be anywhere by now.
Yes, sir, that's true. We've got to start somewhere.
Michaels smiled at that. They arrived at the office where Howard had left Tony Fiorella. Inside, Fiorella and a tall, striking, short-haired blonde stood and looked at an enlarged holoprage image of dozens of faces lined up in rows.
Got the first-run photos from Joe Winthrop, Colonel, Tony said. All with either ears to match our size specs or are covered by hair so we can't see them clearly.
Hi, Alex. Have a good walk?
Yeah, thanks, Michael said. He looked uncomfortable, pale.
Oh, excuse my manners, Tony said. Colonel John Howard, this is Angela Cooper. She is our liaison to MI6. Colonel Howard is the head of the Net 4 strike teams.
The blonde extended her hand and smiled at Howard.
How'd you do, Colonel? Pleased to meet you. He shook her hand, returning the smile. He caught a glimpse of Michael's peripherally. The man had a sickly grin pasted in place, but he looked to Howard as if he was about to throw up.
Cooper released Howard's hand, and he caught her flick a quick gaze at Michael's. He followed it and saw Michaels glance away, refusing to meet her look. It was nothing, no more than half a second's worth of what might be his imagination. But, oh my.
Howard had been around the block a time or two, and he liked to think he was not too bad at reading people. Something was there.
Howard, like most men away from home a lot, had been tempted by the possibility of extramarital liaisons from time to time. Fortunately, in all the years he'd been married, all such thoughts had died before they had gotten more than a few steps from wonder toward action. He didn't think of himself as particularly righteous. He'd sowed a fair number of wild oats as a young soldier before he got married, but he'd put all that aside when he'd said, I do. But he had known a lot of men who had chosen to go and sin some more. He'd seen plenty of these men standing next to women they pretended not to know as well as they did know them. He couldn't have sworn to it, but that little exchange between Michaels and Cooper told Howard something he'd just as soon not know, too. These two had something going on together. And more than that, from how she acted, Tony Fiorella didn't know it. Oh, boy. All of a sudden, Howard was very glad he was not Alex Michaels. very glad. London, England. Ruggiero saw the shooter the second he opened his car door. It was good luck, really. He just happened to be right next to the car and looking that way as he walked along 12 or 13 meters behind Peel. If he hadn't looked just at that instant, it might have been too late. But he had seen the glint of sunlight on stainless steel as the man pulled his jacket shut to hide the handgun tucked into his waistband on his right side. The shooter came out only a meter or so behind Ruggiero, who just kept walking, drifting to his right slightly as if window shopping at a hat store. The shooter, a tallish man with thinning, sandy hair, dressed in a windbreaker over a tan polo shirt, khaki slacks, and running shoes, walked past, intent on his target. Ruggiero glanced around. He didn't see a backup man. He moved away from the window and onto the shooter's tail, hurrying his pace. He reached down to where his mobile phone was clipped to his belt and tapped the send button. The number was pre-programmed, one of two Peel had given him, and the mobile phone on Peel's belt would now be vibrating with the call. No one else had the number, Peel had told him, and if it vibrated, it meant that Ruggiero had spotted a deadly threat too close to use the other number to call and talk about it. Peel made an immediate right turn into the door of the closest shop, a bookstore. The shooter angled that way to follow. Ruggiero speeded up, so that he reached the bookstore's door half a meter behind the shooter. It would be easy enough to blast the shooter, to put him down and out, but they wanted to keep him alive long enough to find out who had sent him. Peel quickly led his would-be assassin down an empty aisle bounded by tall shelves of musty books. Before the shooter could get to his weapon, Ruggiero got to him. He shoved the little Beretta into the shooter's spine and said, "Move and you die." The shooter was a pro. He froze. "Clear," Ruggiero said. Peel turned around, his hand under his sport coat at the right hip. He smiled. "Henry? I thought you retired."
"I should have, so it seems."
"Bit late now," Peel said. "Let's go somewhere and have a little chat, shall we?"
"That won't do, Terry. You know that."
"You can't win, Henry. My man there is ex-Spetsnaz. Why don't we keep it civilized? We might even be able to work something out so that nobody has to feed the worms."
"Really, Terry, I hoped you'd think better of me than that."
With that, Henry leaped to the side, a move unexpected enough so that Ruggiero's shot missed his spine and punched a small hole over the man's left kidney. The blast was loud, channeled by the books and shelves, so that it lapped back over the three men. They had a few seconds left to finish this at most. "Alive!" Peel shouted, pulling his own gun. Maybe Henry realized he couldn't get his own pistol out fast enough to outshoot them. He didn't even try. Instead, he shoved his left wrist to his mouth and bit down on his watchband. Ruggiero knew what that move meant, and apparently so did Peel, who said, "Bugger all!" Ruggiero put his pistol back into his pocket, turned and headed for the exit at a fast walk. Peel was right behind him. Whatever poison pill Henry had just bitten into was undoubtedly fast-acting, and there was no way to torture information from a man who would rather kill himself than reveal it. A pro, all right. Ruggiero respected a man who died well. Outside on the sidewalk again, and moving moderately fast but not running, Peel gained past Ruggiero and headed for his car. "I rather liked old Henry. A shame." As he followed him, Ruggiero considered how he was going to rid himself of the Beretta. He would have to lose it somewhere as soon as possible. Tuesday, April 12th, Washington, D.C. Jay brought Saji a glass of water. "You're really enjoying this, aren't you?" Seated in the overstuffed chair, she smiled.
"More than I should, yes. Does it bother you that much?"
"No, not really. It's the mind that matters, not the body."
"That's to your credit, Jay. You really believe it.
If I had known that when we met, I wouldn't have bothered with the disguise." "So, satisfy my curiosity. Why did you?"
"Buddhism is like a lot of traditional religions, in that for a long time virtually all the ranking practitioners were men. In a lot of circles, if they think you're an old man, you get a lot more respect than if they think you're a young woman. Truth is truth, but a lot of people look to see who delivers it before they accept it. That's how it works in religion sometimes. If you have a choice between a 70-year-old man and a 20-something girl offering nuggets of wisdom, when push comes to shove, you pick the old guy. Old and wise are better than young and stupid."
"That's dumb. If you can walk the walk as good as an old guy, it shouldn't matter. It's what you say, not who says it, that counts." She rewarded him with a big smile.
"I love you. Marry me."
He blinked. "Huh?" She laughed, a deep and melodious sound. We'll get back to that part later. How goes the monster hunt?
About to get really scary.
That's why I'm here. I think I should go with you.
Wednesday, April 13th, London, England. Stevens drove the Bentley along at a proper pace toward the computer works. Goswell reclined in back. Stevens said, "My lord, there is a telephone call for you." "Sir Harold."
"Yes, I'll take it."
Stevens passed over a mobile phone.
"Hello, Harry."
"Hello, Gossie. Out and about, are we?"
"Yes, off for a bit of an inspection tour of one of the facilities. Can't let the help get too complacent, can we?"
"Certainly not. I say, Gossie, this is,
Something bothering you, Harry?"
"Well, yes. You had a conversation with a man by the name of, Pound Sand recently, regarding a matter of some delicacy of which we spoke at the club."
"I do recall that, yes."
"Well, it seems that Mr. Pound Sand has passed away."
"Oh, dear."
"Yes. Quite unexpectedly. I am given to understand that it happened even as he was attending to that very matter of delicacy. That, it was a more or less direct result of that very thing."
"How unfortunate."
"Yes. Would you like for me to give Mr. Pound Sand's associates a jingle? See if one of them might be interested in continuing the matter?"
"Oh, that's decent of you, Harry, but perhaps we should wait a bit on that."
"As you feel best, Gossie. I'm awfully sorry about this."
"Tut-tut, not your fault at all, Harry. It's obvious I underestimated the difficulty of the problem myself. Think no more about it."
As Goswell handed the mobile back to Stevens, however, he thought about it. So, Mr. Pound Sand was now Mr. Pushing Up the Daisies, which meant that Peel was either lucky or good, or perhaps both. That was certainly food for thought, wasn't it? Well, one thing at a time. First, he would be certain that Bascombe Coombs was out of the loop. Then he would figure out a way to deal with the turncoat Peel. Wednesday, April 13th, London, England. "We got a break, Colonel," Fernandez said. Howard looked up from the stack of reports he was reading. They were in Michael's temporary office, and the commander and his second were down the hall talking to one of the MI6 higher-ups.
"How so?"
"Miss Cooper just came up with this." He passed a hard copy wax laser drum photograph over. Howard looked at the Waser image.
"Ruggio."
"Yes, sir." "All right, Sergeant. Where and when?" "Yesterday, the London police were called into an incident at a small bookstore near Piccadilly Circus. They found a body on the floor, shot. The dead man is one Harry Wyndham, a former MI5 agent who ran a security service. Cooper says the local authorities suspect Wyndham was a high-priced and very discreet iceman for rich clients. Turns out the bullet didn't kill him. He apparently croaked from a fast-acting poison. This picture was from the door's occult door cam, one of the two men who left about the time patrons heard the shot. Here's the other man."
Fernandez offered another picture.
Anybody we know?
Cooper's working on an ID. Can we backtrack the dead man?
Cooper is working on that too, sir.
Wednesday, April 13th, Washington, D.C. It was sunny, no wind, a perfect day for working the rangs, and Tyrone headed for the soccer field full of himself. Bella had given her smile back to him. She wanted him around, wanted to see him, had invited him to her house this very evening. Life was better than good. Life was great. When he arrived at the field, Tyrone saw Nadine. DFF. But when he got to where Nadine was, she was already packing up.
Hey, Nadine.
Hey, Tyrone.
Where are you going?
My arm's a little sore. I don't want to overtrain. I've got some ibuprofen gel.
That's okay. I got some at home. See you.
Something was wrong. He could feel it, but he couldn't see what it was.
You okay?
She looked him straight in the eyes.
I told you my arm was sore. Why do you care? You don't need to be skulking with people like me. You got Belladonna.
She walked off. He watched her go, and while he hadn't done anything wrong he could think of, he felt guilty. Somehow he had just failed some kind of test, and he didn't even know what it was.
Damn. He wished his father was home. Dad knew about stuff like this. He needed to talk to him.
Wednesday, April 13th, London, England. Something was wrong, Tony knew. From her years of martial arts training, she had a tendency to view things in terms of physical engagements. What it felt like was, all of a sudden, Alex stood in a defensive stance. Sitting in a strange office halfway around the world from her roots, Tony worried about it. What had happened? Sure, he had a lot on his mind. The looming custody battle, the mad hacker, and their relationship had a few bumps in the road. But none of that seemed to be enough to account for this sudden distance between them.
Miss Fiorella?
She looked up. Cooper.
Yes?
Your Colonel Howard has some information on his assassin. He'd like your opinion on it. He's in the small conference room. Okay, be right there. Cooper left, and Tony shook the worry about Alex. She picked up her flat screen and headed for the conference room and John Howard. Howard glanced away from the holoprage as Tony Fiorella entered the room. Julio was there, but Angela Cooper and Alex Michaels were meeting with one of the MI6 higher-ups and would be a few minutes.
John, what's up?
Tony, I wanted to bring you up to speed on the Ruggio matter.
Sure, fire away.
He laid it out for her, using the holoprage images to punctuate the briefing. He did a fast sit-rep through the stuff she already knew, then got to the new information. The holoprage image shifted to the occult cam view from the bookstore. This man left the store after the incident, at almost the same time as Ruggio. This is Terence Arthur Peel, a retired British Army major. Julio, would you lay out the rest?
Sir.
Ma'am. Peel had a fairly decent career until he was posted to Ireland a couple of years back as part of the standing British force. The peace there is fairly fragile, and Peel was responsible for an incident that might have threatened it. Caught some of the locals doing things they shouldn't have and beat confessions out of them. Peel retired, and the incident was swept under the rug. Next time he surfaced, he was providing security for a local bigwig, Lord Geoffrey Goswell. Peel's new boss is not only a nobleman, he is also richer than Midas, a crusty old billionaire who owns half a dozen companies producing everything from computers to ketchup. Tony looked from Fernandez to the colonel.
I see, and this leads you to believe...
Howard shrugged.
We really don't have enough information to make a conclusion yet, but it seems awfully coincidental that a former intelligent operative gets shot and poisoned and dead in a bookstore, and a few seconds later a known killer and a disgraced army major busted for killing prisoners both saunter out the door. If I was a gambling man, I'd be willing to bet these two had something to do with the death, and with each other.
You think Ruggio is working for Peel? Hired to catch or kill the guy in the bookstore?
It certainly seems as if we ought to have a chat with this guy, Peel.
All right. How do we go about it?
Cooper will set it up. We can go along as observers.
Howard's Virgil peeped, the tone indicating a personal call. Excuse me a moment. He walked away from the table and pulled the Virgil from his belt.
Hello?
Hey, Dad. Tyrone, everything okay? Your mother? Mom's fine. We're 3x3.
Go ahead here, Dad.
Howard relaxed.
What's sailing, son?
Oh, I don't want to bother you if you're busy.
I'm not that busy. Shoot.
Well, there's this girl at school. Howard listened to his son pour out his problem, and he felt himself grinning.
Fiorella and Fernandez ignored him, and after a little while, Cooper and Michaels arrived. Finally, his son ran down.
So, what do you think, Pop?
Well, I could be wrong, but I think your boomerang girl likes you, and she's maybe a little jealous of Bella.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and she might have a point, too.
Why do you like hanging around with Nadine?
She can throw, Dad. She's smart, she's funny, and she's got an arm to sell your comic collection for.
But she's not that much of a looker?
Not really.
And Bella?
Geez, Dad, she's gorgeous.
And if my memory serves, she's also got a mean streak. You remember talking to me about her when she cut you loose before?
Yeah. She thumped you pretty good once before. You got any reason to believe she won't do it again if it suits her?
No, but maybe she realized she made a mistake.
And maybe you're more desirable because somebody else wants you.
Nadine?
No offense, but I can't see that Bella would be the least bit worried about Nadine, Dad.
Well, she's fun and all, but she's not somebody you'd cross the street to get a better look at.
If Nadine is athletic, smart, and funny, some people might find that intimidating, especially if they aren't.
You mean Bella is jealous of Nadine?
Howard chuckled. What else changed, son, since she dropped you?
Nothing, man.
If Bella wasn't beautiful, if she was plain or even ugly, would you want to spend time with her? Think about it. Let it perk for a while and see what comes out.
Oh, man. I guess I better go. Thanks, Dad.
Say hello to Mom for me.
I will. Discom.
Bye, son.
Wednesday, April 13th. Upper Cretaceous, what will be Western Europe. Ferns as tall as pine trees loomed in the sweltering heat, and dragonflies the size of hawks flitted among the lush greenery. This was primeval, primordial, hot, wet, and dank in ways far beyond a tropical rainforest. The wide base Humvee hit a dip, and Jay gunned the powerful engine. The Humvee lurched forward. He spotted the smashed ferns. He slowed, crept a few feet closer, then pulled the UV over and put it into neutral. He glanced at Saji.
You can stay here while I go look. Stand by the gun if you want.
There was a 50-caliber, water-cooled, belt-fed Browning machine gun mounted on the uncovered rear deck of the Humvee. Clipped to the deck was also a shoulder-operated, laser-guided, anti-tank rocket launcher.
I'd rather not, Saji said.
She wore a set of bush khaki shorts and shirt. She was gorgeous in the tropical clothing. He wondered what she looked like without any clothes.
All right, slide over and take the wheel then. Leave the engine running. We might need to take off in a hurry.
He alighted and walked toward the smashed fern boles. He could hardly have missed the footprint. Three toes and a pad, no heel. A little water had seeped into the bottom of the print, which was big enough so if you completely filled it, you could sit down and take a bath. Jay swallowed dryly. Jesus, look at that thing. 25 feet ahead was another footprint. Jay stared at the trail of destruction. It was Rex Regum, the King of Kings. Carnosaur Supreme. Made your average tyrannosaur look like somebody's pet iguana. Probably was 50 feet tall. Following its trail wasn't going to be a problem, but like a dog chasing a car, the question was, what would he do if he caught it? He turned and headed back to the car.
Move over, he told Saji.
Doesn't look as if cutting sign is going to be a problem, she said.
No, I don't think so.
He put the car in gear and started following the monster's trail. Jay had turned the problem over and over, trying to come up with an explanation, any explanation as to how such a brute could exist. What could have created it? And with technology as he knew it, there wasn't any answer. But as they drove down the VR path looking for the beast, he thought again of the old Sherlock Holmes dictum about eliminating the impossible and dealing with the unlikely remainder. Nothing he knew about had this kind of power, and he knew a lot about computers. But, given that the thing existed, what could be responsible? The hardware didn't exist to make it work. But what if, by some miracle, it did exist? Wednesday, April 13th, The Ewes, Sussex, England.
His lordship had gone off to his club, and Peel was in the little church on the telephone on hold. What was he going to do about the bloody scientist? Should he kill him now? Naturally, the first thing Peel had tried to do when he started worrying that maybe Bascombe-Coombs wasn't on the level with him was try to withdraw the million from the Indonesian bank. All Peel had been able to get from his computer login was a transfer pending notation. Given the computer problems worldwide, this could have been a legitimate response, but it was also possible that this might be a clever ruse by Bascombe-Coombs, one easily hidden by the chaos he had himself caused. By the time things cleared up, Peel might be dead.
"This is Vice President Imande Harjo," came a man's voice. "How may I help you?"
At last, the bloody Indonesian banker.
"Right. My name is Peel. I need to check the status of my account. Your name and password, please?"
Peel gave it to him.
"Ah, Mr. Belsong. Yes, I see it."
Peel shook his head. Belsong. The song of a bell, and thus Bascombe-Coombs's little joke. Peel. Same sound, different spelling as Peel.
"You have my account information?"
"Yes, sir, I certainly do."
"I'd like to transfer part of the account into another bank."
"Certainly, certainly. If you'll give me the particulars."
Peel rattled off his English account number.
Mr. Belsong, there appears to be a problem with our system. The computer won't let me make a transfer."
Peel nodded to himself. "Well, well."
"It seems that there are several dozen accounts affected. I'm sure it's only a temporary aberration."
"You mean I can't get my money out until it's fixed?"
Well, I'm afraid so, yes."
"I see." That was all Peel needed to hear. His bowels clenched and went cold. He had a sudden deep suspicion that Bascombe-Coombs was having him on.
"If you will give me a number where I can reach you, I shall call you as soon as we've resolved the problem."
"Right." He gave them his number, but Peel wasn't going to hold his breath waiting for that money to clear. Time to go and have a chat with Mr. Bascombe-Coombs. Yes, indeed. But almost as he thought this, his phone buzzed.
"Yes?" "Hello, Terence."
"Well, well, speak of the devil."
"Hello?" "I'm afraid we have something of a problem. It seems his lordship has given orders cutting my access to my, toy. He has shut down all the apparent external lines and posted a guard to keep me from physically entering the building."
"Really? Why is that?"
"I suspect the old boy doesn't trust me."
Good bloody reason for that, Peel thought. Then another thought popped up.
"Apparent external lines, you said?" "Very good, Terence. Naturally, I have a few digital and microwave transceiver links carefully hidden around the hardware. Even a landline wired into the power supply if anybody thinks to use jammers. They'd have to take it down to the floorboards to cut off my connection, and since they don't know it's there, they won't."
"I see. And what does this mean?"
"I believe we shall have to deal with the old boy, using your area of expertise. Give it some thought, would you?"
The scientist broke the connection. Peel stared at the wall. God, the man had brass balls. Here he was, trying to have Peel himself iced and pretending as if nothing had happened as he ordered him to kill their mutual employer. Bloody nerve, all right. He would, Peel realized, be better off with both of them gone. If Bascombe-Coombs went missing and his lordship fell over with a stroke or heart attack, then Peel would be in the clear, nobody to tell tales. He might not be rich, but he would still be marketable. With a spotless record under his lordship, some other rich fool would find him worthy. Peel smiled. Yes, this was all unfortunate, but not beyond repair. Wednesday, April 13th, London, England. During a lull in the increasingly frantic activity at MI6, Tony got on the comm to call Carl Stewart.
"Hello?"
"Carl?"
"Ah, Tony, how are you?"
"Fine. Look, I'm up to my eyebrows in work and I can't get out of it for class tonight. Sorry."
"Not a problem. We'll miss you, but I understand."
"Thanks."
"Well, you do have to eat, though, don't you? Perhaps we can have lunch or dinner later this week?"
"Are we talking about two Silat students getting together for a bite, Carl, or are we talking about something else?"
"Well, I was thinking along the lines of two people who found each other's company interesting and who had a deep interest, Penchak Silat, in common."
A date. Tony had a momentary vision of what it might be like to lie naked in bed with this powerful and skilled man, and it was not an unattractive daydream. Not at all unattractive. In fact...
She felt a shard of guilt stab her. I'm pretty much involved with Alex, Carl, and I appreciate it, but I think maybe we ought to keep things strictly professional.
Ah, too bad. But certainly I understand. Appreciate your candor. Do let me know when you can come back to class.
I will. Thanks. After she hung up, Tony had a sick feeling. She admired Carl, maybe even had a bit of lust for him, but she loved Alex, and there was a world of difference between those two things. For just a moment there, however, she had considered it. How could it have even crossed her mind? This was bad. Bad.
Wednesday, April 13th, The Ewes, Sussex, England. Ruggio adjusted the 9mm Firestar pistol and the clip-on holster on his hip under his windbreaker. The previous handgun Peel had furnished him was at the bottom of the Thames, wiped clean and broken into pieces. The 9mm would do the job for Ruggio, and there was the umbrella to back it up. In addition, he had bought a Benchmade tactical folder, a knife that could be flicked open with a thumb to lock its 4-inch tanto point blade rigidly into place. He considered leaving, simply catching a boat or train or plane out of the country, then heading home. Peel wouldn't miss him in time to stop him. Ruggio, however, was tired, and looking over his shoulder made him more tired. He did not need another enemy dogging his trail. No, he would finish this business with Peel first. One way or another, he would resolve things. Once he was home, then what came, came, and he would deal with it. Peel came out of the converted church and nodded in his direction before setting off for his own car. Washington, D.C. There had been an all-out assembly at school, and when it was done, Tyrone drifted down the hall. He was headed for the bus queue. He saw Bella, walking and laughing with three girlfriends. She spotted him and smiled.
Ty, hey, over here.
He felt that rush of belly-clenching cold energy that radiated excitement all the way to his groin. He started toward her, holding his steps slow so as not to seem in a hurry.
Hey, Bella. We're going to the mall. You want to come along?
He smiled.
Sure, why not?
He glanced past Bella and saw Nadine walking down the hall. Nadine saw him, then looked away. Bella caught his look and flicked her own gaze in that direction. It was quick, but Tyrone got it. Nadine had been inspected, stamped failed, and dismissed, all in a haggard glance. And all of a sudden, Tyrone Howard, pushing 14, found himself at the crossroads of the rest of his life. You've got the comm in your hand, Tyrone. Who are you going to call? Maybe he could still do both.
Why don't I meet you at the bus? I got something I have to take care of first.
Bella might not be the brightest diode on the board, but she wasn't so dim she couldn't see immediately what he was doing.
We're going to the mall now, Ty.
What was left unsaid was, now or never, Tyrone, your call. Well, shit. The moment stretched for a couple of million years. He felt like he was going to explode. Damn, damn, damn. Hell with it. He made his decision.
Nadine! Hey, Nadine! Hold up for a second.
Nadine turned, surprised he could see. He didn't dare look back at Bella, though he wanted to see her face. Nadine smiled, and her face didn't seem so plain.
Your girlfriend just left without you. Didn't look real happy either.
He shrugged.
So what?
He felt bad, but he also felt good at the same time.
How's the arm? You want to throw some? You sure about this?
I'm sure. The smile got bigger.
My arm is a lot better now.
Yeah, let's go throw. As he walked along next to her, Tyrone felt his own smile begin. Something his dad had told him. When you do the right thing, it almost always feels better than when you don't. Score another one for the old man.
Thursday, April 14th, Upper Cretaceous, what will be Western France.
Looks as if he can swim, Saji said. Jay pulled the Humvee to a halt and shut the engine off. The monster's tracks led to the edge of a sea and disappeared into the water.
Looks like, he said.
What now?
We change vehicles, boat or helicopter.
He pulled a GPS handheld from his jacket and consulted it. This is a cheat in this scenario, since there are no global positioning satellites in this time, but I'm not really sure this body of water would be here either.
Where is here?
Coast of France. What will be Great Britain is over the horizon that-a-way.
So in RW, that's where the trail leads?
That's what it looks like, yeah.
Are we going after it?
Oh, yeah. I want to drop out of VR for a while to check some stuff and give the boss a call first.
Thursday, April 14th, London, England. In the MI6 conference room, Michaels sat waiting for Jay's visual to appear on the call-waiting holoprage that floated bluely over the table. With him were Tony, Howard, Fernandez, and Angela Cooper. Howard said, "We've got an appointment to see the retired major out at his employer's estate in Sussex this afternoon." "No more attacks on major webs or military systems to note," Tony said. "Looks as if our hacker has backed off, at least for the time being."
"I'll take any good news I can get," Michael said. "Let's get Jay off of hold."
The holoprage flickered and Jay Gridley's face appeared in the air. "Hey, boss."
"Jay, this is Angela Cooper of MI6. You know everybody else." Jay murmured greetings. "Okay, tell us what you got."
"Well, it's not much. I have been on the program's track, and it looks as if it's leading in your direction. I've been thinking about the problem. No working computers we know about could brute force prime number encoding the way this thing has. The first thing that comes to mind when you ask yourself what kind of computer could do it is, of course, a QC, a quantum computer. The thing is, none of those are past the small experimental stages, so none of them would have the power needed to pull off what has happened. But what if somebody had one? A fully operational model? It would blow through prime number encryptions like a tornado through a straw house."
"Big if," Tony said.
"Yeah, but I've done a little poking around. None of the various militaries and corps who have gone to the new AMPD standard, that's abstract multidimensional point distance encryption, were bothered by these attacks. Could be coincidence, but a QC wouldn't be able to crack those."
"All right," Michael said. "But if somebody had created such a thing, wouldn't we know about it?"
"Well, eventually. You couldn't keep it hidden forever, but maybe you could for a while."
"And in your expert opinion, this is what you think it is?" That from Howard.
"Yes, sir. Nothing else comes close. I've searched the web and found everybody serious who's ever published anything in the field. On the list are a couple of guys in the UK, one of whom, a man named Peter Bascom Coombs, did some flat-out brilliant theoretical work a couple of years back. I don't even know anybody who could stay with him. He used to be in London, but he's dropped out of sight. It seems odd a guy that sharp would just disappear."
"Give us what you have on him and we'll check it out locally," Michael said.
"Already uploaded. I've got to get back to the hunt. I think I'm going to be able to run this beast down. I'm close."
"Be careful, Jay," Tony said.
"Yeah, thanks. I'll keep you posted."
Angela had been tapping commands into her flat screen.
"Got the information about Mr. Bascom Coombs. I'm running a search..."
"Hello?"
"What?" Michael said.
"Here's our man.
Employed by Comco UK. They are a privately held computer company that produces, among other things, high-end workstation motherboards."
"He's a computer geek working for a computer company," Fernandez said. "Is this a big surprise?"
"Oh, not in itself, no, but Comco UK is owned by Lord Geoffrey Goswell."
"Where had you heard that name before?" Michaels wondered.
Then he remembered. Howard beat him to saying it. "Is that the same guy whose security chief is the one in the store with our assassin and the dead guy?"
"Yes,"
Angela said. "Well, well," Howard said. "Small world." Michael shook his head. He didn't like coincidences. "Tell you what, put off that interview with Peel for now. Tell him you've gotten things resolved. I think we need to know a little more about his boss before we go blundering into his den." Howard nodded, as did Fernandez and Tony. Angela gave him a small smile, and he felt his heart stumble and bang into the wall of his chest. He did not look at Tony. He couldn't take the risk.
London, England. As he drove away along Old Kent Road, passing the gasworks, Peel was royally pissed. Bascom Coombs had taken the day off yesterday, and when he'd gone to find the man, he'd missed him. According to his operatives, Bascom Coombs was not in evidence at his flat, nor did he have his automobile, which was parked in his garage. Another pass by the office suite was also a waste of time. Where the devil was he? It was his own fault, Peel knew. He had pulled his men off because he wanted to deal with Bascom Coombs himself. His phone chimed at him.
"Hello, Peel here."
"Major Peel, Angela Cooper here."
"Miss Cooper, I haven't forgotten our appointment this afternoon."
"As it happens, sir, we won't be needing to speak to you after all. The matter at hand has resolved itself. Sorry to have bothered you."
"Quite all right."
Thursday, April 14th, London, England.
When Tony came back from the loo into the conference room, Alex and Cooper stood at the end of the conference table talking. They almost literally had their heads together. Tony felt a pang of jealousy. They looked up, saw her, but didn't move. That was good. If they had jumped apart, that would have been something to worry about.
"Anything new?" she asked.
"We've got the intel on Goswell and Peel," Alex said, "and some interesting developments. Colonel Howard and Sergeant Fernandez are on their way here." Even as he said it, the two men arrived. "Angela, if you would." Cooper stood as the others took their seats. She touched her flat screen and a projection lit over the conference table.
"Lord Geoffrey Goswell's estate in Sussex," she began. "It's called the Yews. He spends most of his time there. Except for staff, his lordship, he's a widower, lives there alone. He has places in London, Brighton, Manchester, a villa in the south of France, and various houses or condominiums in Wales, Scotland, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, India, and the United States. Here is a list of the companies he owns all or part of. His personal fortune is estimated at just under $2 billion. Peel, whom we've discussed at some length before, heads Goswell's personal security. He's got anywhere from 6 to 10 men, all ex-military, patrolling the estate. We've put a couple of teams on the roads leading to the estate, and less than an hour ago a rental car arrived there. Our operatives managed to get a blurry picture of the driver, and it appears to be the computer scientist. Major Peel, also under surveillance, is currently en route to Sussex on his way from London."
"No sign of Rougeau?" Howe asked.
"No. Could he be at the estate?"
"It is possible. We won't have any spy sats in position to footprint the area for another 90 minutes. Even so, and even if he is strolling on the grounds, we would be hard-pressed to identify him from that alone. We have, under the aegis of national security, tapped the landlines into the estate, as well as having scanners recording wireless activity."
"Sounds like most of the eggs are in the basket to me. We need to take a little run out there and have a chat with some folks," Fernandez said.
"Well, yes, that would be the logical next step."
"But," Howard said,
"well, this is awkward. What if you were in the States and you suddenly had to question a billionaire who was also a powerful political figure, a senator or even the president? You couldn't just knock on his door and demand to come in, could you?"
"No," Alex said, "but we've had our presidents testify when he didn't want to, even impeached."
"After weeks of consultation with his lawyers."
"The effort was made," Alex said. "No man is above the law."
"And men are not above the law here either, Alex, but this is a small country, and despite our attempts to bring it into the 21st century, still very caste conscious. Lord Goswell is at the acme of power here. He plays bridge with the king. It's one thing to call up and tell his head of security you are going to drop round for a chat. It's quite another to demand the same of one of the richest and most powerful men in the country."
"Even if we suspect he's involved in the computer assaults?" Tony said.
Cooper turned to face Tony. "Even if you for sure he was responsible and could prove it, Mrs. Fiorella."
Alex said, "Can you have your field ops pull Peel over and keep him from getting back to the safety of Goswell's estate?"
Cooper stared at him.
"Why would we want to do that?"
"Okay, follow my logic here. Let's suppose that Bascom Coombs is responsible for the computer disruptions. If he is, he has to be doing it with help. According to Jay Gridley, this isn't something you can do cheaply, so somebody substantial has to be backing him."
"Yes, so?"
"Occam's razor. He's working for Goswell. How many people can fund a multi-million-dollar project and keep it secret? Wouldn't that have to be somebody with a lot of clout? That gives us Goswell. And wouldn't Goswell's chief of personal security have to have some idea who Bascom Coombs was? Any op worth his paycheck would surely run background checks on people who cozied up to his boss."
"You're saying that Bascom Coombs is the mad hacker, that Goswell knows about it, and that Peel also knows?"
"Stands to reason if they are all sitting around having tea together, doesn't it?"
Cooper gave him a small smile.
"Come now, Alex. People who have tea together don't share all their secrets, do they?"
Alex flushed. John Howard turned and suddenly found a fascinating spot on the empty wall to stare at. Cooper's smile grew bigger and warmer. On a sudden, deeply intuitional level, an article of solid nitrogen formed and stabbed Tony in the heart. My God, had Alex slept with this bitch? How? When? God in heaven, why?
Alex cleared his throat and said, "Look, we know Peel is connected to Rougeau and the death of a suspected Iceman." There was a long pause. Tony stared at Cooper with the new suspicion still piercing her to her soul.
All of the rest of this was nothing. It didn't matter about Peel or Goswell or Ruggio. None of that was important. Had Alex betrayed her? Surely not. He couldn't have. Could he? She felt sick. Cooper said, "All right. I'll have to get D.G. Hamilton to sign off on it, but I suspect we can do that much in the interests of national security." Thursday, April 14th, M23, south of Gatwick. Ruggio took a couple of deep breaths and blew them out, trying to relax. He'd been growing more tight as he drove. A tight man could not move properly. Ahead of him, and one lane over, the gray Neon with the two men in it that had been following Peel since London cruised 50 meters behind the major's car. As soon as he had spotted them, Ruggio had made the call and had spoken but one word. "Company." That had been enough to alert Peel. "Got it. I'll call back later." They had passed Gatwick Airport a few miles back. The mobile phone on the car seat next to him rang. Ruggio picked it up. "Go ahead." "Have they made you?" "No." "Good. We're getting off at the next exit. Down that road 3 miles, there is a large oak tree. At an intersection with a narrow road to the right. 2 miles down that road, on the left, is a big shearing barn. We'll have a chat with our company there. Why don't you go on ahead and get set up?" "Yes." Ruggio thumbed the connection off. The oak tree was where it was supposed to be, and the barn, in front of a field of grazing sheep, sat alone and quiet in the middle of a long stretch of nowhere, a perfect place to have a chat with somebody you didn't want anyone to overhear. Ruggio pulled his car into the barn and shut the door behind it. He heard the sound of an approaching engine. He took a deep breath and let it out, stretched his neck and rolled his shoulders. He was ready. He would follow Peel's lead. Peel pulled his car onto the hard, packed dirt next to the barn and circled to his left to force the following car to pull in between him and the building. The Neon pulled off the road right into a perfect position. Two men got out. They wore windbreakers. One was a medium-tall brunette, the other a shorter, stockier man with mouse-brown hair cropped short. "Good afternoon, gentlemen. May I help you with something?" Mouse Brown said, "Major Peel, we wonder if you would come along with us, sir. If you'll explain who you are and what you want, maybe we can keep this civilized." "We didn't come to answer questions. Please step over here, sir, and keep your hands in plain sight. Gentlemen, I advise you to stand still and keep your hands away from your weapons." Medium Tall grinned and said, "Begging your pardon, Major, but you don't really think you're good enough to take us both." Peel raised his voice. "Mr. Ruggio, are you there?" The barn door swung up with a creak of rusted hinges, and Ruggio appeared in the doorway.
"I am here."
He held the silvery pistol in both hands, pointed at Medium Tall. The two men panicked and went for their guns. Ruggio had Medium Tall, so Mouse Brown was Peel's. But before he could clear his weapon, Ruggio fired. Pow, pow, pow. The tiniest hesitation, then pow, 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 again. 6 rounds at maybe 5 meters, and it was so quick it sounded like 2 bursts of fully automatic submachine gun fire. Damn, he was fast. Medium Tall and Mouse Brown went down like sickled wheat. "Shit!" Peel yelled. He hurried toward the downed men. Both were wearing body armor under their jackets. He could see that as he got close. The vests had stopped 2 rounds each, just as they were supposed to, but body armor had not stopped the rest of Ruggio's Mozambique drill. 2 to the chest and 1 to the head. Both men had been shot between the eyes, and they were effectively dead before they hit the ground. Peel had never seen the drill perform better.
"Damn, how am I supposed to find out anything if you don't leave one alive to question?"
Ruggio gave him a Slavic shrug. Well, there was not any help for it now. Best find out who these two were, if he could. Peel fished in Medium Tall's pocket until he found a wallet. He opened it, then stared at the ID card behind the clear plastic window. "Oh, Lord. These blokes are MI6.
just killed two of His Majesty's SIS agents.
Rougeau shrugged again.
Peel shook his head.
Come on, help me move the bodies. We've only got a few minutes before they're missed.
They were in the crapper now, weren't they?
MI6, London, England.
We have a problem, Cooper told Michaels. We've lost contact with the team following Peel.
Howard, Fernandez, and Tony had gone to the cafeteria to grab a quick bite, and Michaels was alone with Cooper in the conference room.
Do you have a way to find them?
Not exactly. The location transponder in their car stopped sending its signal. We've sent a military strike team via helicopter to check it out.
They're either taken or dead, he said flatly.
We don't know that.
You wouldn't have scrambled an airstrike team if you didn't think it was likely.
She sighed, put one hand on his forearm.
He stared at her hand. After a beat, she broke the contact.
No chance for us, is there?
It wouldn't be a good idea. I'm sorry.
She smiled, but it was hollow.
The good ones always get away.
Pity.
Your Miss Fiorella is lucky, you know.
I think I'm the lucky one.
Thursday, April 14th, near Balcombe, England.
MI6 had sprung for a second copter, and it landed with Alex, Howard, Fernandez, Cooper, and Tony. The strike force copter was still on the ground, and a dozen soldiers moved around the big old barn. Tony had tucked her personal pain away into the box of professionalism and locked it tight. A British captain approached and spoke with Cooper. Tony walked around, bent to examine the ground in a couple of spots, then drifted toward the barn. Alex said, Tony? He stood next to Cooper and the British captain.
She could do this. She could keep her feelings at bay and do her job.
This is Captain Ward, Alex said.
Cooper said, Why don't you bring Sub-Commander Fiorella up to speed on what you think might have happened here, Captain?
A flash of anger enveloped Tony. She wanted to smash Cooper's smug face.
Instead, she said, It's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Cooper blinked.
Oh, really? Why don't you tell us then?
Sure. Peel had a backup man. That's his car in the barn. It will be a rental and won't have a back trail.
Your agents must have missed the backup.
Odds are it was Mikhail Rougeau, who must have some kind of link to Peel.
Peel led your men here right into a trap.
How am I doing so far?
She looked at Alex, and his face was frozen into a half grin. He felt her anger, she knew.
She nodded at him. I know, you bastard, and now you know I know.
Cooper didn't speak, nor did Alex or the captain. So Tony continued.
There are two small spots of blood on the ground, still visible, though somebody kicked dirt over them. Peel or Rougeau shot them, most likely in the heads. That's where they fell. Then they shoved their bodies into their own car and left here driving that and Peel's. By now, I guess they've driven the car with the bodies in it somewhere it won't be found for a while. If I were in charge, I'd have the local constables drag any big ponds or lakes within a few miles of here.
Anything else you need to know, Ms. Cooper?
Not at the moment, Ms. Fiorella.
Cooper gave Alex a quick look, and in it Tony saw a measure of what she thought might be concern, pity even.
Michaels pulled his Virgil and put in a priority call to Jay Gridley.
Yeah, boss, what's up?
If I gave you an address, a physical address, for where this QC hardware might be, would that help you search?
Couldn't hurt. Might be able to spot a trail if I'm close enough to it, though there's no guarantee.
Stand by, I'm uploading it now. We found Bascom Coombs and where he works.
Thanks, boss.
Be careful, Jay.
Michaels walked to where Cooper stood.
Does this change things? Can we go to Goswell's and grab Peel?
I can check with the DG, but I'm afraid it won't matter.
Sorry, Alex, but that's how it is. Our hands are tied.
On their way back to the helicopter, Michaels lagged behind.
Hold up a second, Colonel.
Howard slowed.
Cooper says MI6's hands are tied. They can't go traipsing into Lord Goswell's estate without an engraved invitation.
Wonderful.
Colonel, I don't know how good your grapevine is, but I put you up for promotion.
I had heard the rumor, Commander. Thank you. I appreciate it.
I mention this only because an international diplomatic incident might squash your chances.
Probably would.
Howard grinned. If that would let me catch Rougeau and this mad hacker, I could live with it.
Michael smiled back at him.
Somehow I knew you'd feel that way.
When we get back to MI6, I think our crew needs to take a break, go for a ride in the country, or something.
Yes, sir.
Michaels looked at the copter. Most of the time, he colored between the lines. Now and then, he had to go outside the boundaries. There was a difference between justice and the law, and sometimes the end did justify the means. The worst that could happen to Michaels if he screwed this up was that they'd fire him in disgrace and put him in jail for 20 or 30 years. As he watched Tony climb into the helicopter, pointedly not looking at him, he knew there were heavier prices to pay for screwing up, or in this case, almost screwing somebody. Maybe, if he was lucky, he'd get killed in this clandestine operation. Upper Cretaceous, what will be London. On foot, the rocket launcher slung over his shoulder, Jay sniffed the air. The usual jungle odors were there, and there was another smell. Next to him, Saji wrinkled her nose and said, Lord, what is that stench? Not to put too fine a point on it, it's monster shit, he pointed. Ahead of them was another thicket of prehistoric jungle, representing reams of coded packets, an electronic locus, a nexus, that in RW corresponded to a computer company in London. Upon the path was a mound of scat. Off to the sides of the path were a dozen or so other mounds, dried and hardened. The two of them circled around the fresh deposit. Jay said, Not to pretend I'm any better at cutting sign or anything, but I'm pretty sure it went this way. And I'd bet it came out here to do its business because it lives in there. Saji shook her head. I don't much like the idea of going in there after it. Jay unshipped the rocket launcher. Me neither. He shouldered the weapon, aimed it at the jungle, and squeezed the trigger. The rocket whooshed away on a flaming trail, arced into the woods, and blew apart in a fiery kaboom that spewed leaves and other bits of trees all which way. A couple of more of those ought to get its attention, Jay said. The Ewes, Sussex, England. Peel alighted from his car and slammed the door shut a bit harder than necessary. He got a grip on his irritation, nodded at Huard, who was standing watch at the rear of the main house, then turned to watch as Rougier got out of the passenger side. The car with the two dead agents in it, along with the gun that killed them, was at the bottom of a stock pond on one of his lordship's farms in East Sussex. The SIS would likely get around to finding the car and its cargo eventually, but he should have plenty of time to clean up the loose ends and get the hell out of the country. And while he wouldn't be getting that phantom fortune from the Indonesian bank, Goswell had a safe in his house that would surely yield running away money. His plan was to ice Goswell, that bastard Bascom Coombs, and Rougeau. Some artful arranging of the bodies so that it would seem as if the ex-Spetsnaz agent had killed the other two, then been shot by one of his men, Huard, say, who'd have to be iced as well. And Peel would be off. Stay here and keep your eyes open, Peel told Rougeau. Rougeau saluted with his rolled-up umbrella. He'd likely need that soon. The sky threatened rain. Perfect. A storm to make things even gloomier. Peel walked over to Huard. Tell the boys to move out to the perimeter. We might have company. You watch the back door. Yes, sir. Peel headed into the house. He would get it all done. Goswell was having a drink in the sitting room.
Hello, Major.
Your lordship. Where is Mr. Bascom Coombs?
Down the hall in the study, I believe, playing with his portable computer. A drink?
A splendid idea. Applewhite materialized. Too bad he would have to die as well. He liked old Applewhite, and Peel held up two fingers to indicate the depth of his scotch. Thursday, April 14th, London, England. The Net Force team rode in what Howard called his mobile on-scene command center, essentially a large RV he had hurriedly rented, with Julio Fernandez driving. The rest of the strike team had already piled into cars and trucks at the military base and were on their way to the meeting place, in this case, a fire station in Sussex. Howard had a computer set up on a small table, and Michaels and Tony sat next to it, watching. Howard brought up an image. This is Goswell's place. I had Big Squint, USAT, footprinted this morning. Now, here's how I see it, Howard said. We wait until after dark before we hit the place. My men do the tango with the estate's guards, while Sergeant Fernandez and I and a couple of others hop the fence and head for the house. We set off some flashbangs and some puke lights and take out any guards there, go in and round up everybody. We can feed any incriminating information about Goswell back to our hosts later. With any luck, by the time the locals figure it out, we're on our plane and halfway across the ocean. One small addition, Michael said. I'll be going in with you. He glanced at Tony, about to say that she'd be staying at the command center. The look in Tony's eyes was reptilian. She knew what he was going to say, and he suddenly knew, if he said it, whatever chance he might have of patching things up between them was going to die right here and now. So instead, he said, "And Tony will be going in, too." She gave him a short nod. "Thank you." At least she was still talking to him. Better than nothing. When they got to the fire station, the Net Force strike team was already there. Angela Cooper was there, too. "Oh, shit," said Fernandez. "Looks like the game is about to be canceled." Alex stepped forward, but before he could speak, Cooper raised one hand to his objections. "If I wanted to stop you, Alex, I wouldn't be here alone. The DG and our MP know what you found out, and unofficially, they believe what we all do." "So you've decided to look the other way?" "Yes, provided we have an unofficial observer." Tony said, "So we do the dirty work, take care of your problem, and if it all blows up in our faces, you get to keep your hands clean." "Can't put anything past you, can we, Ms. Fiorella?" Ruggiero leaned against the stone wall of the big house under the substantial roof overhang. The wind had died pretty much as the rain began, so he was dry enough. And he had his umbrella, of course, and a feeling he would be needing its hidden functions before the night was over. Intelligence services of every country he knew of took a dim view of anybody who killed any of their operatives. In Peel's shoes, what would he do? Flight was the only real option. Even Goswell could not protect him if he stayed here, and timing was critical. Peel would have to disappear before things grew too warm, and he would wish to depart without any telltales left behind. Peel had sent his men to the property's borders, leaving only Huard and Ruggiero here. They, along with everybody inside the house, were expendable. That's how Ruggiero would see it in Peel's place. So, sometime during the night, Peel would call him inside. Next to the parked lorry, Howard slipped his helmet on and checked the low-seer comm. "Perimeter team, sound off by the numbers." The strike team obediently replied. "Entry team, sound off. This is E1, Cooper. E2, Michaels. E3, Fiorella. E4, Fernandez. And he was E5. Five of them should be enough. They all wore the light SIPE suit configuration, mostly just armor, comms, the tactical comp to run the helmet. They all carried the simple but reliable H&K 9mm subguns and tactical pistols, save for Howard and his .357 revolver. And as soon as he'd brought out that, Julio had howled.
"Why, Katie May, I must be going blind. My tired old eyes completely shot. What is that ugly lump on the top of the colonel's antique good luck charm? Is that a dot scope, or can't be?" "Julio? No, I must be on drugs or out of my mind. The Colonel John Howard I know would never in a million years upgrade to hardware just because it was state-of-the-art and useful." "Never let it be said your commander is a total Luddite."
Howard smiled. Peel glanced at his watch. Almost 9. Bascom Coombs hadn't come out of the study. He was hunched over his computer, wearing a headset and finger bands, deep in some VR scenario. Well, fine, he could die never knowing what had hit him, for all Peel cared, and good riddance. Goswell had tottered off into the dining room for a late supper, and Peel had the sitting room to himself, working on his third scotch. He'd have to get started soon, but he was stalling. He took another sip of his scotch. The monster, which looked like a cross between Godzilla and a giant Spielbergian raptor, stomped out into the clearing that served as his toilet and loose a bellow that shook fronds off the ferns.
"There he is," Jay said redundantly.
Saji looked up.
"No shit."
Jay swallowed dryly, put the laser sight crosshair on the monster's chest. He jerked the trigger. The rocket streaked away, smacked into the monster's chest, and exploded. When the fire and smoke cleared, the monster was knocked down.
"All right, Jay," Saji yelled.
The triumph was short-lived. The monster rolled, used its tail as a prop, and got back to its feet. It looked around for the source of the attack.
Oh, shit.
Saji was already shoving another rocket into the bazooka-style launcher. The rocket lanced into the beast again. Boom! Again it knocked the thing asprawl. Then it climbed back to its feet again and roared.
Man, well, at least it was having an effect. Thing was, they had one more rocket and then the party was over. They could bail from VR if it got too close, but if they had to bail, the thing would win, and Jay did not want to let it do that.
But it didn't look good for the home team, no sir. Reloaded. Jay took a deep breath and readied his last shot. Sure enough, Bascom Coombs was still there in the study, waving his hands around, wiggling his fingers. Peel glanced up and slipped into the room. He pulled the small cold steel Culloden boot knife from the sheath on his belt. He stepped up behind the computer scientist and caught his forehead with his left hand, then drove the knife into the base of his skull with his right. Bascom Coombs stiffened. The monster opened its toothy mouth and screamed that terrible scream again. Then it froze in that position, jaws agape.
What is it doing?
Jay shook his head.
Hell if I know, but there's my target.
He lined up the crosshairs on the thing's open gullet, held his breath, and pulled the trigger. Bascom Coombs jittered a few times, then collapsed. Peel pulled the knife out of the man's hind brain, wiped it on the dead man's shirt, and put the blade back into the sheath. Now, let's see. There was Goswell, the maid, the cook, and old Applewhite left inside. Then Ruggio. Huard he could save until last. The boy would never have a clue. He went down the hall toward the dining room to have a word with his lordship. This time, when the rocket exploded, so did the monster's head. Erzat's brain and bone and blood sleeted in all directions.
You got it! You got it!
Saji hugged him. He hugged her back. He had done it. He had redeemed himself. And it felt better than pretty damn good. It felt absolutely great. Jay Gridley was back. Thursday, April 14th, The Ewes, Sussex, England. The entry team made it to within a few hundred meters of the house without any trouble. In the headset, Howard said,
"See anything, E4?
Fernandez was on point.
"There's one just passed under the light by the back door. Looks as if he is walking patrol."
"Copy. Let's move in."
Ruggio caught the movement in the field during a lull in the rain. A few seconds later, he caught another glimpse of something. Peel's men were good soldiers, but the estate was too big for them to cover properly. Ruggio moved deeper into the overhang shadows, circled away from the house, and headed toward the building that Peel used for an office. If he was lucky, he could still slip away. Goswell wiped his lips as Peel came into the room wearing a smug smile. "Oh, well, here we go." Goswell had sent Applewhite upstairs with the maid and cook and told them to lock themselves in the upstairs office and stay there until he personally told them to come out. Now he could finish this unpleasant business.
"Oh, do have a seat, Major."
"I think I'd rather stand, if it's all the same to you, Geoffrey."
"Geoffrey, good God. Peel's gone round the bend." "Did you see Bascom Coombs, then?"
Yes, that I did. I just left him in the study, quite dead."
"Killed him, did you?"
"I'm afraid so."
"Oh, pity. He was quite brilliant."
"And he was also a psychotic, willing to do your bidding, and who also tried to have me killed."
"Did he? Well, apparently his assassins fared no better than mine, then."
Peel frowned.
"Yours?" "Yes, of course. I'm afraid perhaps you've made a mistake, and poor Bascom Coombs has been made to suffer for it. It was I who had people trying to kill you, sir."
"But why?"
"Really, Peel, for conspiring with that very same Bascom Coombs you have slain in my study. Did you think me such a fool that I wouldn't remember that someone must watch the watchers?"
"Ah, so it is you having me followed, and that fellow in the bookstore."
"I am sad that it was necessary. Your father would be most unhappy with you. I thought you were made of better stuff, Major."
Peel laughed. "Well, I've got to hand it to you, your lordship. I never tumbled to it being your doing. And it's not as if Bascom Coombs was some innocent who didn't deserve his fate. Though I must say, you are awfully calm for a man who's about to have his throat cut. A gentleman to the end, eh?"
"Well, I should hope so. Although I confess that I don't expect that end to occur this evening."
With that, Goswell brought his Rigby double up from his lap and pointed it right at Peel's heart. With that, Peel lunged.
"All I see is one," Fernandez said. "You want me to put a couple of rounds in him? Pick a spot and say when?"
Howard considered his options. It seemed possible they could pull this off without anybody getting blasted. He'd rather do it that way, considering how delicate the politics were. Michaels had gone out on a limb a few times for Howard. The least he could do was return the favor.
I'll get his attention. While he's focused on me, you take him out. Non-lethally, if possible.
Copy non-lethal, E5.
Howard crawled to within 20 yards of the house. The guard was heading in his direction, and he had to attract and keep his attention long enough for Julio to get to him and choke him out. He needed a noise that would make the guard curious but not afraid.
Meow. Mew, mew, mew.
Sure enough, the guard started heading his way.
Mew, mew.
The man grinned.
Kitty. Here, kitty, kitty. Oh, you lost in the rain? Come here. I'll dry you off.
Good. He was a cat lover.
It was going to work.
And it might have, if somebody hadn't fired a shotgun inside the house just then. The guard spun toward the door, saw Julio coming at him at a dead run, and whipped up his gun.
Well, shit, Howard thought.
Then he opened up with his own sub-gun, a triplet, into the guard's back. The guard wasn't wearing armor. He went down.
Go!
Howard yelled into his comm set.
Peel looked at the bloody hole in his belly and knew he was not going to recover from this gut shot. He wanted only one thing, to take fucking Goswell with him. He grabbed at his pistol, pulled it free. Goswell stepped closer and aimed the shotgun at Peel's face.
Sorry.
The next explosion blew out Peel's lights forever. Howard rolled through the door and into the kitchen. He came up ready, but save for Julio, already on guard, they were alone. He pointed down the hall, and Julio nodded. They cleared rooms. When they got to the study, there was a body on the floor next to a portable computer. The dead man wore portable VR gear. They rolled him over and saw his face.
Bascom Coombs, Julio said. Deader than last week's Liberty.
Yes. Got to the dining room, they found the second corpse, and an old man sitting at the dining room table with an open double-barreled shotgun in front of him. White smoke hung like dense fog in the room.
You shooting black powder in that thing?
Julio asked. The old man was Lord Goswell.
You don't look like any of the security boys I know. Americans, are you?
Yeah, we're new, Julio said. What happened here?
Well, Major Pugh went mad, I think. He killed Bascom Coombs and came for me. I had to shoot him, I'm afraid. A terrible business.
Peel and Bascom Coombs both dead. Howard shook his head.
Jesus.
Julio said,
where is Ruggio?
The old man frowned.
Who? Oh, you mean the new Russian fellow Peel hired. Well, I expect he's around somewhere. He was here earlier.
Stay here, Howard said. We'll be back. Heads up out there, people. Ruggio is still loose. They headed out. Michaels, Fiorella, and Cooper were covering the back. As they stepped out into the yard, Howard said, split up. Commander, you are with me. Cooper and Fiorella, you are with Fernandez. Do what he says. Let's go find him. From where he stood, hidden by the outbuilding's corner, Ruggio could hear the American's voice, though he could not quite make out the words.
He sighed. He could have run a long time ago. He could be back in Chechnya by now. But that wasn't really home without Anna. Wherever she had been his home. With her death, he had been cut loose, adrift, a sere leaf blown by the winds of fate. He sighed again. Enough of this. He unfolded the trigger from the umbrella's handle and stepped out from behind the cover of the building and into a cone of light. The five members of the team were only a few meters away, backs to him.
Save yourselves the trouble, he said.
They turned almost as one, all their guns leveled at him.
Drop it, one of them yelled. Drop the umbrella?
He saw them relax slightly. He had given up. They had him. He snapped the umbrella up and started point shooting. Howard felt the impact of the bullet on his weapon, and when he tried to return fire, the subgun fired one round, then jammed. He let it go and snatched at his revolver. He heard the others yelling, shit, fuck, ow! The S&W came out of its holster. He jerked the revolver up, found the glowing red dot, and brought it back down. Why the hell wasn't anybody else shooting at him? Brought the dot down, centered it on the man's chest, and cooked off two rounds. Boom, boom, and watched him fall. And the son of a bitch was smiling as he fell. Howard ran to the fallen man, stood over him. Both 357 rounds had hit him square in the middle of the chest. The dying man looked up at Howard.
Anna,
he said. That was all.
It was just about wrapped up. Fernandez came over carrying the umbrella Ruggio had used. He held it so Michaels could see the gun mechanism inside. Five-shot revolver, see? Ingenious little thing. Michaels nodded. He also saw the bandage on Fernandez's right hand, where the small caliber bullet had hit it. Michael's own weapon had been disabled by a bullet that hit the magazine. Tony had a small wound on her right hand like Fernandez's, and Angela's glove had failed to stop the bullet and had broken her thumb. Howard's subgun had taken a round against the bolt. The man called Ruggio had hit all five of them hard enough to keep them from shooting back, and it was only Howard's handgun that had finally put an end to it. It was amazing. Nobody here had ever seen anybody shoot so well. If he had had an armor-piercing weapon, he could have killed them all. Too bad he wasn't on our side, Fernandez said. He'd have made a hell of a small arms instructor. You're sorry he's dead?
No. And, well, yeah, kinda.
Michaels understood that.
All right, let's get out of here, Howard said. The party is over.
Friday, April 15th, London, England. Tony had taken another room without discussing the situation with Michaels. As he headed to the lobby of the hotel to meet her, he wondered what she was going to say. They were supposed to go home today. The flight was booked. The case was over. The Brits had cleaned up the mess at Goswell's. There was nothing to tie the old man directly to anything. The witnesses who could have implicated him were all dead. Bascom Coombs' miracle computer was also dead. Some kind of time destruct code that didn't get turned off when he wasn't there to disarm it. The Brits had the machine, but they didn't know what it was they had. Maybe someday they could puzzle it out. So, no international incident. Bad guys, mostly dead. It could have been worse. But there was Tony, standing near the big potted plant in the lobby. She looked at him and her face was so sad he thought she might cry. So sad it wanted to make him cry. Tony, I'm sorry, No, not today. Your flight leaves in a couple of hours.
My flight?
Yes, I'm staying here for a while. But no, I have a lot to think about, Alex, and so do you. She looked at him, and he saw the tears forming, starting to spill. Tony, you don't understand. No, not now. Don't say another word about it. Tears streamed freely down her face now. She didn't know he hadn't actually slept with Cooper. And when he got right down to it, did it really make that much difference? Would she even believe him? Okay, sure, take some time, whatever you need. We can deal with this when you get back to work.
No, we can't.
I'm not coming back to work. It's too much for us to have professional and private lives mixed together. I quit, Alex. As of today, right now, this minute, I'm no longer working for NetForce.
What? You can't.
You aren't going to tell me I can't do anything right now. Maybe not ever. Goodbye, Alex. I'll miss you. With that, she walked away. Michaels watched her leave, unable to speak, to move, even to breathe. Oh, God, Tony. What had he done? He stood that way for a long time, as if in a trance. And when he came out of it, she was gone. Gone.